KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. To y'all, or good morning to you, or good day, whoever you may be, wherever you might be. Welcome to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. It's good to be with y'all tonight. Got a busy show planned, but first, my props to Miss Corey. New Wave Radio Theater, every Monday, 10 p.m., 1 hour before this program. Corey does it up with wonderful theater on the radio. New Wave Radio Theater, every Monday, 10 p.m. Check it out with Corey every week, okay? Before that, Kelvin and Eric, doing it up. Jazz plus blues equals global economic collapse. Tech Radio at 6 p.m., keeping us up on the outrageous world of high technology. And, of course, Jeff Wheeler starts things off from 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday with Uncommon Light. Good music, good talk, good news. a rainy Monday night. I guess you can call it spring. Moon's about three-quarter full if you could see her. And, you know, it should be an amazing full moon, by the way, on Friday night. The equinox, actually, the vernal or spring equinox is this Friday, the 21st of March, and it's a full moon as well. So you might check that out. But at any rate, you're listening to it here on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, your imagination station. Glad to be here with y'all and a part of it. All right, a big thank you to Dr. Gordon Pedersen, doing very, very important work, in my opinion, there at American Biotech Laboratories. I mean, if the claims made on patent number 7135195 and the statements made by Dr. Pedersen last week on this program are true and legitimate, and I believe that they are, then we really are at a crossroads. I mean, because this really is the silver bullet, and it is aimed center mass at the heart of the military, industrial, pharmaceutical, congressional, collegiate complex. And it is the death knell of the New World Order, which is actually the Old World Order. So anyway, let's just hope that whatever forces are at work make the best of what those folks are doing over at AVL. All right. Also, thanks to my friend Finn O'Loughlin for the fantastic music. I think he's just awesome. It was great to talk with him on the phone as well. And I just loved the music last week. So check him out on the web, finnolachlan.com. By the way, all the musicians that I feature on the program can be found on the website. Just click on over to the music archive section, okay? All right, if you missed the program last week or any other for that matter, you can always hear them after the air settles. They're on the web, www.mikehagan.com, in the program archives, okay? Take a look around there. If you happen to find something you like, share it with somebody else if you get the notion, okay? All right, tonight at the midnight hour, Dr. Martin Ball will talk about visionary plants and their medicinal and ceremonial spiritual utilization. You can get a leg up at martinball.net or link on over there to his site from mine. But before that, in just a few minutes, Mr. Bill Ferguson. Bill is the father of Ryan Ferguson. Ryan is a young man in the middle of a very controversial criminal case that's been on people's minds here in mid-Missouri for some years now. And we'll get an update from Bill on new developments in that strange case. And we'll talk to him in just a few minutes. I don't know if we'll have time to do space weather later in the program. If not, at least remember that full moon on the Friday equinox, like I said, in just a few days. And we'll see what else we can fit in. But right now, I think we'll do a quick another piece of music. And let me get my act together here, and then we'll come back with Bill, okay? It is time then. We'll hear another song from our featured artist of the evening, Martin Ball, on the web at martinball.net. We started the show off with a song called Festival of Waters, and that's sort of appropriate. It's been raining all day here, but at any rate, we'll hear another one right now, and yes, this is the same Martin Ball we'll be interviewing later this evening. Martin is, among other things, a talented musician. Here's an example. It's called, well, it's another good one in the same sort of tone as that first one we started the show off. This one's called Miriam Down Under. All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Back in just a minute with Bill Ferguson. Miriam Down Under. That's Martin Ball, and we'll hear more from Martin throughout the rest of the program tonight. Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, and it's just about 14 minutes after the hour of 11 p.m. on the what's the date? Well, of course, St. Patrick's Day, the 17th of March, 2008. And I'm here with Mr. Bill Ferguson in the studio with me tonight. And if you're not familiar with Bill, I'll let him tell you quickly a little bit about himself and the case that we're going to be talking about for a little bit here. At any rate, he has been on the air with me once before, I think, but it's been at least a year. And there have been some new developments in the case of his son, Ryan Ferguson. And before I misstep, I'll just say hello to Bill, and we'll let Bill talk for himself and tell us a little bit about what's going on. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Hi, Mike, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
And to you. Do you have any green beer yet today?
No, I have not.
Good. Me neither. That's such disgusting. Bill, for people who are unfamiliar, before we talk about the current developments in the case, I'd like you to give a quick little background and framework so people who are unfamiliar can at least have an idea of what we're talking about.
Of course. If we go back to November, or actually October the 31st, 2001, that was Halloween night, here in Columbia, Missouri, Ryan had just turned 17 by 2 weeks, and his friend, Chuck Erickson, was 17 by about, I think, maybe 3 months. The two of them had gone to the By George nightclub, and obviously they were underage, and they left around 1:30, and Ryan's story is that, which I totally believe, is that he took Chuck home, went home himself, and used his cell phone to make telephone calls, and then went to bed. But Chuck, after 2.5 years, now, there was a murder here in Columbia that you may be familiar with, the audience, and that was, unfortunately for Mr. Ken Highholt, was murdered in the parking lot of the Columbia Tribune.
Right, he was the sports editor of the Tribune at
correct,
the time.
Correct. And that occurred in the early morning hours of November the 1st, 2001. And 2.5 years after that, Chuck Erickson started thinking that, well, perhaps he might have had something to do with that crime. And he told a couple of his friends he may have had a dream, that he may have been involved. Nothing specific, just a general concept. And one of those people called the police. They arrested Chuck on March the 10th, 2004, along with Ryan, who was in Kansas City.
Your son?
Yes, correct. And they were arrested and charged with the murder of Mr. Highholt. And then a couple of years after that, or maybe a year, actually October 2005, the trial for Ryan Ferguson started. But in the meantime, Chuck Erickson and his parents, in fear that the police would give them a severe penalty, decided to plea and testified against Ryan. And he pled guilty in November of 2004. And then in 2005, they had Ryan's trial, and Chuck was the chief witness against him. And at the end of that trial, October 2005, here in the Boone County Court, Ryan was found guilty and sentenced to 40 years. So that was the situation as of October 2005.
And Ryan is currently in prison right now.
Yes, he is in Jefferson City.
And so is the other young man, Chuck Erickson.
Yes, he is.
Both
that's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Fast forward. I know that over the last couple of years, since the trial was finished, that you've done a lot of work on your own. You've talked to whole lots of people. You've been have been very busy. So I guess the reason that you're on the air tonight is because there are some new developments. And so I guess I'd like to ask what's going on with Ryan's case to begin with right now in the mid spring here in 2008.
Well, in the interim between Ryan's trial, October 2005, and March the 3rd, in that interim, we did file for a couple of appeals, which we were turned down, which we were not the least bit surprised. It would be unusual to succeed. But during those appeals, what people should understand is in those appeals, and we went all the way to the Missouri Supreme Court, we could only talk about issues that were already presented in the trial transcript. and we could only talk about mistakes the judge may have made. So it was a very narrow framework of information that you could deal with. And we
that was on the first appeal.
Yeah, exactly, okay. Which we appeal all the way to the Missouri Supreme Court.
Right.
And you basically have to do that before you get to where we are now. And it's just a procedure you have to go through to get to where we are now. And now, since we've gone past that, fortunately, now we can present a motion for ineffective assistance. And while we do that, we can subpoena witnesses, we can talk to witnesses, and we can introduce new evidence.
Hmm.
And now, in the interim, we have discovered a volume of new information, new evidence, new witnesses, and now we're presenting that in an 86-page document called the Supreme Court 2915, Ineffective Assistance, in which, and the most significant of that is that we have filed two Brady violations committed by the local, the past prosecutor, Kevin Crane.
All right, hold on. First of all, what's a 2915?
The 2915, and I'm not exactly certain, I'm obviously not an attorney, but it's a ruling from the Supreme Court that allows you to present a motion for relief and vacating a sentence that's been passed. And it gives you an opportunity for a remedy to introduce new evidence to show that your defense attorney was not effective, and in this case, ineffective. And in addition to that, when you do that, you also can introduce new evidence, and that's what we're doing.
What is exculpatory evidence?
Exculpatory evidence, as I understand it, is evidence that the prosecution comes across that is beneficial to the defense, and they have an obligation under the 14th Amendment and under the various other rules from the Supreme Court. They have to pass that on to the defense team of the defendant.
Okay, and one last thing for definitions. What's a Brady Bill violation or a Brady violation?
A Brady violation is basically the same thing, but it's a law case that occurred in 1963, Brady versus Maryland, in which the prosecuting attorney did withhold exculpatory evidence to the defendant. And as a result of that Supreme Court hearing, they do now have an area of the law called Brady violations, and that's when the defense fails to inform the defense of information that would be advantageous to the defense.
When the prosecution fails to.
Yes,
right.
Correct.
Okay. All right, and for clarification, this is different than the Brady Bill that people know with regard to gun control and all that thing, right?
Correct.
Okay. Well, what does all of this mean for Ryan's case?
Well, in the first case, this 86-page document, if anyone would like to download it, they could go to our webpage, and the entire document is there for anybody to download and read at your leisure. And if you have trouble finding it, you can email us at freeryanferguson@aol.com.
Okay.
Or you can go to his webpage, which is freeryanferguson.com, either one of those two. But the most significant of the two Brady Bill violations was a situation where there were two witnesses, allegedly two witnesses to the crime. They were standing on the and on the dock at the back of the Tribune, looking out into the parking lot of the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
And those two witnesses are Shauna Arndt and Jerry Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
And Shauna Arndt gave her testimony in court, as did Jerry Trump. But it turns out that Shauna Arndt has, in the interim, made a statement to Ryan's attorney saying, and this is very important, saying that she spoke to Kevin Crane after their arrest and prior to the trial and emphatically told him that the two that she saw in the parking lot, and let's look at Shauna Arndt for a moment, who she is. She is the person that the police asked to draw two composites of the suspect she saw. They chose her because she had the best look. They never asked Jerry Trump because he never had a good look at the two suspects in the parking lot. She had the best look. And the police characterized her in an April 2003 newspaper article as the person, they characterized her as the sole witness and as a person that saw the face, the only person that saw the face of the suspect. Now we go forward to her conversation with Kevin Crane after they were arrested. And
who is Kevin Crane for people? Crane for people who aren't familiar?
I'm sorry. Kevin Crane was the prosecuting attorney. He is now a sitting judge in the Boone County Court.
Uh-huh.
But at that time, he was a prosecuting attorney. And one week after, or within a week or a few days after they were arrested, and a few days before the trial, on two different occasions at least, they had a conversation, Shauna Arndt and the prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
And in that conversation, she told him, in her statement, she says she told him emphatically that she saw Ryan and Chuck's photographs in the newspaper, and she saw them on television, and she told the prosecutor that those two boys definitely were not the suspects she saw in the parking lot.
They were not the people that she saw in the parking lot.
Absolutely. They were not the two people she saw in the parking lot. They were, the person she saw in the parking lot was older, and there were some other characteristics as well. Definitely older. She looked at the person's face, and she was less than 20 feet from that individual, so she got a very good look. There was a light above her head shining into the parking lot, which illuminated her face and the crime scene. So she had a very good look.
Hmm.
The exculpatory evidence and the Brady violation on the part of the prosecutor is that he failed to tell anybody this evidence. He kept it to himself, and he denied Ryan a fair trial and a violation of the 14th Amendment, plus a whole host of other things. And that's what the Brady Bill's about. That's one of our motions, one of the things that we have in this 86-page motion. There are other things as well, but I think this is the most significant. When you have when the key witnesses has a conversation with the prosecutor, so there's no misunderstanding of secondary people.
Mm-hmm.
She talks directly to him and tells him emphatically that those are not the two people, and then he in turn fails to follow the law and tells. And does not tell the defense attorney.
Right.
That's a major problem.
And she's on the record now as doing this.
Yeah, she has a sworn affidavit, a sworn statement, and she's prepared to go on the witness stand and make that statement. And in fact, she will.
Mm-hmm. All right. There's another gentleman involved. His name is Jerry Trump. Let's talk a little bit about him and why he's important to the
case.
Well,
Jerry Trump, and just for background, is an individual that was sentenced to prison for 5 years for child molestation with sexual conduct, and he was placed in prison. And then just before a couple of months or 3 or 4 months prior to the murder, he was released on parole.
Okay.
After serving 120 days.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up working as a custodian, and not directly for the Tribune, but for a separate business that did custodial work for them.
Mm-hmm. They came in and do the cleaning every evening or something like that.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's how he and Shauna, she was also a custodian, that's how the two of them found themselves at the back of the parking lot or the back of the Tribune they didn't see the crime, but right after the crime. So mm-hmm. That's how the two of them ended up there. The night in question, the police questioned Shauna Arndt and felt like she gave a good enough description that they had her assist them in drawing a composite, and they used her description. One of the officers in the police report characterized Jerry Trump as a person that had very little useful information. So as a result, they never talked to Jerry Trump. And after that, the next day would have been the first. They did a follow-up interview with him on the 2nd. And from the 2nd of November 2001 until December the 21st, 2004, the police never had another conversation with Jerry Trump. In the meantime, Jerry Trump violated his parole and was sent back to prison to serve his sentence. On December the 13th, 2004, he was released from prison. And here is an interesting set of circumstances that I find personally very difficult to believe. Jerry Trump is invited to the prosecutor's office. Now, he didn't volunteer to go down. He was invited by Bill Haas, the prosecutor's, one of the prosecutor's investigators.
Mm-hmm.
And he joined the two of them in the prosecutor's office on the 21st of December 2004 for the purpose of, the alleged purpose, to listen to the 911 tape and to walk the crime scene. And during the that discussion, he revealed to them that he had received a newspaper article, a newspaper story, that pertained to Ryan and Chuck's arrest on March the 10th. And I don't know if any of your listeners remember, but in that newspaper article, which actually came out on the 11th of March.
In 2004.
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm.
March 2004, they had their two high school photographs and then their two arrest photographs. And Jerry Trump says that he received, while he was in prison. That while he was there, he received a letter, an envelope from his wife, with this newspaper story in it. And his, he alleges that he opened the newspaper, or the envelope, and he saw the two photographs from, of Charles Erickson and Ryan Ferguson. And he alleges that he immediately recognized them as the two people in the parking lot. But he also says, and this is the part I find most extraordinary, now this would have been March of 2004, the end of March 2004, he didn't tell a single individual about this revelation. He doesn't tell his wife. He doesn't tell his cellmate. He doesn't tell the police. He doesn't contact anybody. He is totally mute on this subject. Now, he's not a stranger to the victim. He actually says in the trial transcript that he opened the door and to allow the victim to go out into the parking lot, the last person that ever opened the door for the victim. And so you'd think there would be some sort of a connection there. But still, he did not contact anybody about what he discovered in this envelope, this newspaper story.
Who sent him the envelope?
He says his wife sent it to him. And that's what he testified to.
For what reason?
I don't know what the reason was.
Anybody ask the wife if she actually sent it to him?
As it turns out, no one ever talked to the wife about that. And if you, in the moment, let me get back to that.
Yeah.
In the meantime, he was shown a video. The Columbia Police Department, apparently the first time ever, they created a video of the actual what they knew about the crime, the 911 call, the tracking dog following the scent from the crime scene to the University of Missouri campus, and a lot of other things. A part of that video is that they offered a $2,500 reward for anybody that would have information that would lead to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrators of the crime, and also gave a toll-free number. And he admitted in court that he had seen this video, but still he did not contact anybody about this. Then we have the trial, October 2005, and Jerry Trump is called as a witness, and he says, and he stood up in court, actually he didn't stand up, but from his witness chair, pointed Ryan out as the person he saw in the parking lot. So that was pretty crushing testimony.
Hmm.
But then, looking back over the trial testimony, I was thinking, gosh, this just seems very difficult to believe. It turns out on April the 23rd, I had a conversation with Mrs. Trump, April the 23rd, 2007.
So last April.
Yes.
All right.
And in that, and I told her who I was, and I had this conversation with her, and in this conversation, she revealed to me that she definitely did not send the newspaper article to her husband. So there is definitely a problem here. She's saying she didn't send it. He's saying that he did receive it. And the interesting thing is, he doesn't tell a single individual
he
about
this. He gets invited
this.
To Crane's office, and then he reveals it, supposedly.
Right. It seems like he goes into Crane's office.
Did he make a deal for some? Well, is there anything in it for him, perhaps? Or?
I have no idea.
Hmm.
All I do know is he didn't tell anybody
but he was
this.
A guy just out of jail, and you're on parole, and you're sort of in a little bit of trouble with these people.
I said in the beginning, it seems a little odd.
Mm.
I do have a problem with that. Now, if you know, when the prosecutor withheld evidence already, with Shauna Arndt.
Mm-hmm.
It looks a little suspicious. I'm not saying the prosecutor did anything wrong in regards to Jerry Trump, but I'm saying it looks a little suspicious that Jerry Trump didn't tell anybody. It's almost as if Jerry Trump became aware of this information on December the 21st, 2004.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Other new evidence.
Other new evidence. Chuck Erickson's testimony, and if anybody wants to read the court transcript, they are certainly more than welcome. We have the entire transcript on our webpage, freeryanferguson.com. It's right on the front. You can click onto it. You can read his deposition. You can view our YouTubes. We have four different YouTube videos for people to watch. And in his testimony, he says that well, he changed his story numerous times. But in the final version, the one that he told in court, he says that he saw a another person, Dallas Mowry, stop at a stoplight mm-hmm. on Providence and Locust. Now, prior to that, he said he saw the same individual at Providence and Ash stopped at a stoplight. Now, bear in mind, 911 was called at 2:26 in the morning, and I know it's a little confusing keeping up all these numbers, but 911 was called at 2:26 in the morning. So it takes a few minutes to get to the intersection, or at least a minute. And so that would be, you could say, approximately 2:30. My understanding is at 1 o'clock, the traffic lights on Providence do not cycle anymore.
They flash.
They become, yes, that's exactly right. They become flashing yellow lights, except for the intersection of Broadway and Providence. So there's no reason for Dallas Mowry or anybody else traveling north or south on Providence to be stopped at a stoplight, because there are no stoplights after 1 o'clock. And bear in mind, the crime didn't take place until between 2:15 and 2:30.
No, and I drive home from this radio station every Monday night. I get off here at 2, and so I'm always on Providence. And, yeah, those lights are always just flashing. There's no red or green lights at that time of the night.
Yeah, and I came down just this last Halloween and walked through the whole crime scene, exact time frames, and it's always flashed yellow. In fact, we have an affidavit from the Missouri Department of Transportation, which they state that was the fact on that night.
So that's
an impossible story. Mm-hmm. And Dallas Mowry, in the meantime, has provided a sworn affidavit saying that he wasn't there, he didn't own a car, he didn't have a driver's license, and he did not see or talk to Chuck Erickson or Ryan Ferguson that night. So that story is...
It's pretty much been discounted.
And I think we know it's a discounted story because the prosecutor, I mean, you would think this is a fairly important witness, the prosecutor never called Dallas Mowry to testify in this case, and now we know why.
Okay.
Once he left Dallas Mowry, Erickson says he goes back to the By George nightclub. Now, the By George nightclub closed at 1:30. In its 10-year history, now, I agree they did have some summonses for serving minors underage, but in its 10-year history, they never had a summons for being open after 1:30, ever. Charles Erickson says that he returns to the By George nightclub the second time. He would have arrived around 2:45, and he says as he approaches the door on the way to Ryan's car, the front door of the By George nightclub, he sees the bouncer, the same bouncer that let him in originally around 11:30 that night, earlier. They went to Ryan's car, they came back, and the bouncer let him back into the nightclub, now about 2:45. I always thought that this would be another good person to talk to, but no one ever talked to this bouncer, and I found out who he was. We tracked him down, and we have a sworn affidavit from him. His name is Mike Shook, and he was the bouncer that night. He has, as I said, written a sworn statement, and in his statement he says that he never was present in his two years of employment at the By George nightclub, was never present after 2:15, again, making Charles Erickson's story unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a host of other things as well, but these are just the key elements.
Hey, I've got one for you that's just sort of a personal one that's been sort of digging at me since I've been interested in the case. And I'm not really unbiased just because I know you, but I really have just been interested in the case. And my my agenda is that the truth be told, frankly. I mean, I hope that Ryan and Chuck didn't do this, frankly, and I'll tell all my listeners that, you know. I don't think that they did, frankly. But if they did, I want that truth to come out. I want everyone to know what happened. I want the truth to come out with this thing. But I've had a question about Chuck Erickson and his, and I don't want to pick on him because I don't know him or anything, but I know that he was sort of a troubled kid, and I'm interested in his psychiatrist or psychologist or people who were talking with him about, you know, his mental state, perhaps, over the course of this whole time. In other words, I find it very strange that for 2.5 years, you know, nothing, but then this kid all of a sudden just decides that he was part of a murder, and I'm wondering if there's any background there.
You know, that's going to be a subject of quite some controversy, and there will be expert witnesses called in this hearing that will testify. And the best I could do would be to speculate, so I'm not going
okay.
to.
Okay.
I do appreciate that. But, you know, I discovered another thing, and anybody can read these transcripts and discover this for themselves. When I talk to people, I say, well, what do you think was the state of mind of Ryan and Chuck that night? And a lot of people say, well, you know, they were probably drunk out of their minds, drug-crazed teenagers. And how else do you explain a murder like that? And when you go back and look at the testimony, and bear in mind, Chuck Erickson is trying to present the most negative characterization that he possibly can to get a better deal for his plea agreement. And in his court testimony, like I said, anybody can read it. It's right there for anyone to read. Between 10:30, when Ryan picked him up, until 2:30, in that time frame, Chuck Erickson does not say anything about consuming any sort of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
He also admits that he only had 2 to 3 drinks in a college bar. Now, I think most of us know that a college bar, the drinks are weak at best.
Mm-hmm.
And so how drunk can you be in a 4-hour period consuming only 2 or 3 drinks? And his actual quote in the trial transcript is 2 to 3 drinks at the most. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, well, the reason he got mixed up and thought that he first saw Dallas Mowry at Ash and Providence and then had to change it to the direction the dogs went after conveniently reading the discovery was because he was just so drunk he couldn't remember. Now, I don't think too many people would think you could get too inebriated on 2 to 3 college-style drinks in a 4-hour period. So that may go to some that there's something just not right if someone says they cannot remember a story or what happened that night because it wasn't because he was drunk or high on drugs.
Okay. All right, well, lots of new stuff and certainly very important, this whole business of exculpatory evidence and Shauna, and the strangeness with Jerry Trump. So, okay, what's next for Ryan?
Well, the next thing is May the 6th, we'll actually hear this, we'll have the hearing.
Okay.
And my understanding is that the prosecutor has said in the paper he revealed all the information to the defense that was known.
Hmm.
Well, Shauna Arndt disagrees with him on that, and we have found there are several other things. One major problem I have with Prosecutor Crane is that, and if you look at our video number 3, he says to the jury in his closing argument, the victim did not have a hair in his hand, and his hand was not bloody. If you look at our YouTube 3, you will see the victim's hand with the hair in it, difficult to see, but you can definitely see the hand is bloody. He misled the jury. His own police detective Nichols, talks about the hair in the hand, and we've included a Highway Patrol lab report where they refer to the hair in the hand. And also, there's an FBI report that they refer to the hair in the hand. So I think it's going to be very interesting when we have this hearing, and prosecutor, now Judge Crane, will be on the witness stand and be sworn to tell the truth and be asked these questions. I think there's going to be some very serious questions to be asked, and I think we'll all be interested to see what Judge Crane's answers will be.
All right. Well, I look forward to it, Bill, and I'm sure a lot of other people do, and I hope that the papers and the other news media in this town will be covering the story and keeping their eyes on what's going on, because it is an interesting one, and one that I'm convinced that we don't have all the answers to yet.
Mike, I'd just like to say thank you for the opportunity to present Ryan's side of this case, and I'd like to take a moment to thank all of Ryan's supporters all around the world. He has a great following, and more and more people are starting to believe his case even stronger, especially in view of Shauna Arndt's statement, the fractured story of Jerry Trump and his wife saying that she didn't send him the information.
Mm-hmm.
We're really looking forward to this hearing, and once again, I'd like to thank everybody for your support. If you have any questions, you can email us at freeryanferguson@aol.com. Thank you so much, Mike.
No problem, Bill. Thanks to you. And once again, that email address, freeryanferguson@aol.com, and the website, freeryanferguson.com. All right, Bill. Take care.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Okay, we are going to shift gears here. I will play a piece of music and get my guest, Dr. Martin Ball, on the line with us, and then we'll come back and do a couple more things before the top of the hour, and then we will have Dr. Martin Ball at the midnight hour, okay? Once again, big thank you, Bill Ferguson. Interesting news on the case of his son, Ryan Ferguson, and the now 5, 6, 7-year-old murder mystery of Kent Heitholt from Columbia, Missouri. Okay, it's Mike, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. This one is called New Life. Back in just a few minutes. We'll be right back. New Life is the name of that song, and it's Martin Ball. We'll hear more from Martin throughout the program tonight. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 8 minutes before the midnight hour now. Still the 17th of March, 2008. Coming up on the 18th real quick, though, all right? Okay, hello. It's everybody listening to us this evening on KOPN over the traditional airwaves or over the Internet. Live or otherwise, every Monday we broadcast this show from the wonderful studios of KOPN in lovely downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we stream the show live as well on the web at kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button there on the website, and you'll get a nice 64K stream. You can listen to the radio station anywhere on the planet, at least anywhere you get a decent Internet connection, okay? Thanks to everybody who makes it happen live on the radio and live on the Internet. Speaking of the Internet, thank you to my good friend Larry Noriger, the web wizard, always helping me out on the website and doing good stuff. If you're an artist of any variety, but an artist like Larry, well, you can certainly share your art with us, and we'll find a place for it on the website if we can, and share it with other people, okay? We will do our best, and if you're interested in what I'm talking about, you can check it out yourself. Go over to the website at MikeHagan, H-A-G-A-N.com. Take a look-see, and let me know what you think. You'll have access to everything that I'm doing over there, and I encourage you to share your thoughts, all right? There is a bulletin board forum that's always busy and active. Lots of interesting topics being discussed over there. More than I can keep up with, for sure. And a live chat room that's up and active tonight and any other time people decide to use it. Always a big thank you to Chaos for putting that whole thing together for me. And I appreciate all the help that I get from, you know, all of you who are part of the Orbit family. So, anyway, I'll peek into the chat room for questions and comments as we move through the program here with Martin. And I always encourage my guests as well as my listeners to join us there in the chat room and in the forum. It's a great way to communicate with sort of like-minded individuals or otherwise. Okay, my email address, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. Send email to me. I'd love to hear from you. Same thing goes for the guests and musicians that appear on the program. Always feel free to contact us, because that's what this is all about, communication, yeah? Okay. All right, once again, the website, MikeHagan.com. And quickly, upcoming guest tonight, as I mentioned, just a few minutes, actually, Dr. Martin Ball. Next week, the 24th of March, I will be in Colorado. My good friend Kyle will be hosting the program as my honored guest, and I'm sure he'll do something fun. So check out the program next week, 24th of March, guest host Kyle Cook. And you never know what he's got in his bag of tricks, okay? Nikki Scully, I was going to talk with Nikki on the 24th, but because of the Colorado trip, we're going to move that to April 7th, I think. Not quite confirmed, but probably April 7th for Nikki Scully. The 31st of March, I'll probably do something in honor of Terrence McKenna. His passing will be 8 years, believe it or not, on the 2nd, on the 3rd of, 3rd of April. Okay. David Abram, author of Spell of the Sensuous, one of my favorite books. Not sure exactly when, but still trying with David. Roy McAllister, Graham Hancock, a whole bunch of people in the wing, but we'll talk about that a little bit later, okay? A couple of announcements. The Labyrinth Party on Thursday, March 20th, that's on the Equinox. I mentioned earlier that the Equinox was actually on the 21st, Friday, but the actual astronomical date itself will take place sometime during the 20th of March on Thursday. And there will be a party at the Sacred Walking Labyrinth at 521 East State Street. That's in Jeff City, between the old Correctional Center and Hamilton Hall Apartments, south of the Union Pacific Railroad tracks there in the Missouri River. And that should be a great time. I'll be down there from 5:30 until I don't know when, but anyway, at the Sacred Walking Labyrinth in Jeff City for the Equinox celebration on Thursday evening, 5:30 p.m. That should be great. Let's see. One other thing of note before we take a quick break, play a piece of music, and then get to our guest for this evening, Dr. Martin Ball. I wanted to mention, as I always do, people of note. This evening, in particular, Maria Sabina has a birthday, the 17th of March, 1894. Maria Sabina, of course, was the Mazatec curandera, Mazatec shaman from Oaxaca, Mexico, who encountered Robert Gordon Wasson in 1955 on a trip that he and his wife were taking to Mexico. On the 19th of June, 1955, Maria Sabina introduced Gordon Wasson to psilocybin mushrooms during a healing ceremony that they call a Veleda or Valleda in the native language. And participants partake of the psilocybin mushroom as a sacrament to open the gates of the mind. It is seen as a purification and as a communication and communion with God or with the sacred. At any rate, Gordon Wasson became the first Westerner, followed shortly thereafter by his wife Valentina, to experience this at the hands of a master shaman. And he wrote about, he and his wife both wrote about their experiences with Maria and the mushroom in an article for Life magazine in 1957. And it was a momentous time and actually a quite astonishing and historical discovery, even though it may not be regarded as such yet by most people. It certainly is regarded as such by me. And, well, to Maria Sabina, here's to you, my grandmother. Dejila ida mi kunsi mi unsi. Thank you, Maria. Thank you for everything that you've taught us and what you share with us. All right, everybody, it's Mike, and it is Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll play one quick one here, and it's called Prayer for Miriani. And once again, this is Martin Ball. We'll hear some more from Martin throughout the program tonight. Music, wonderfully, from the same man that we'll be talking to for the next couple hours, okay? So, once again, here's a taste of what you'll be hearing and what you've heard already throughout the program. This is Prayer for Miriani. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Back in just a couple minutes with Martin Ball. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
That's right, it is Mike Hagan, and you are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest this evening is Dr. Martin W. Ball. Dr. Martin Ball is a writer, he's an independent publisher, a musician, currently living in Ashland, Oregon, I think. He is the author of the epic fantasy series Tales of Arduin. And he's also authored two other books on entheogenic spirituality, one called Mushroom Wisdom: How Shamans Cultivate Spiritual Consciousness. The other book is called Sage Spirit, Salvia Divinorum and the Entheogenic Experience. Martin's PhD led him to do research on shamanism, Native American traditions, entheogens, Eastern philosophy, and meditation. For his dissertation project, he lived for over a year just off the Mescalero Apache Reservation in New Mexico, where he studied with several traditional medicine people and learn traditional Mescalero medicine and ceremonialism. We'll get to some of the details of Martin's work right now as we say hello and welcome to Radio Orbit. Hi, Martin. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
And a pleasure for me, too. Hey, first of all, we'll talk more about music sometime later in the program, but great stuff, and thank you for sharing it with me.
Oh, well, thank you for playing a few songs there. I really appreciate that.
All right, cool.
And hope your listeners enjoy it.
Oh, I think they are. In fact, I got to peek in the chat room and see what people are saying. But before we get ahead of ourselves, I'd like to do some background for people who are unfamiliar with you and your work and, who you are. Perhaps a little bit about yourself and how you got on this particular path.
Okay, wow. Well, that's kind of a big open question.
That's exactly what I wanted it to be.
All right, well, yeah, you mentioned that obviously you've been playing my music, and I've written a few books, and I'm also currently doing a podcast, The Entheogenic Evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I have my PhD in religious studies. I got that from the University of California, Santa Barbara. That was back in 2000, so it's been a few years now since I completed that. And for that, I ended up at the Mescalero Apache Reservation doing research out there and kind of living and working with a lot of the medicine people out there and studying what is called their mountain spirit tradition. And I actually kind of fell into that in the sense that, well, I'll back up a bit. I was a philosophy undergraduate at Occidental College in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was an undergraduate in philosophy, I just really got frustrated that we were only reading Europeans, we were only reading dead American males, and we weren't really getting anything outside of a very limited perspective from Western culture. And
right.
So I was drawn more and more into the religious studies department and taking classes in religious studies and also kind of going through my own, I guess, spiritual quest and trying to decide, you know, what's out there, what do I really believe about things. I mean, I grew up in a very scientific, rationalist household. So that was really something I had to discover on my own. So I got further and further into religious studies and went to graduate school really planning to study Buddhist philosophy. I was really into Tibetan Buddhism at the time and was looking to be doing a lot more of that. And I was studying Sanskrit. And at the same time, I started getting interested in Native American traditions. I mean, I had some exposure to it before.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, my grandfather had grown up on a number of reservations when he was much younger.
Wow.
And so he had lived with the Ojibwe, the Navajo, the Lakota.
Mm.
He was actually initiated into the Mediwinwin Society among the Ojibwe. He was fluent in all three of those languages, actually. And he was also initiated into a Navajo ceremonial way, a blessing way. So I kind of grew up with that around my grandfather, but not something that I'd really studied academically. And my first term as a graduate student, I was actually in a seminar, and it was a seminar on comparative mysticism. And there was a list of names that was being passed around the class by the professor, and he said, everybody pick a name, and then you can give a presentation on that person, do some research on it. And so the person who was just to my right picked Nagarjuna, a Buddhist philosopher. That was the name on the list I really wanted to do. And so when the list came to me, I just said, well, you know, can I do like a Native American mystic? And I just finished reading like all of Carlos Castaneda's books. And, you know, obviously they're fairly controversial books, but I was kind of thinking, well, I could do Don Juan or something like that. And another professor said, well, go talk to this other professor who does Native American traditions, and you can, you know, ask her who you can give a presentation on. I don't know. So I went over to go talk to the professor for Native American studies and just kind of got deeper and deeper into that. So I ended up out on the reservation in New Mexico among the Mescaleros and started going out there probably in 1995 and then actually lived out there in 98 and 99 and doing my research. And also within my study, I was very interested in traditional medicines, you know, just shamanism more broadly speaking, not just among the Mescalero culture, and very interested in entheogens and visionary medicines, and so studied a lot of that in school and, you know, studied a little bit of that independently on my own.
Yeah.
But that way.
Where'd you grow up as a younger person?
I was actually born in Santa Barbara and lived there until I was about three or four. Actually lived in Isla Vista. I don't know if you're familiar with Santa Barbara at all, but Isla Vista is kind of this student ghetto. And my dad was a professor at the university at the time, or perhaps he was just doing his postdoctorate work. He's a chemist. And not that kind of chemist. He's just a chemist.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And,
but
and,
you spent most of your life in California, huh?
Yeah, and then we moved to Chico in Northern California. And so I lived in Chico really until I went to college and spent summers in Santa Cruz, because my dad would teach at UC Santa Cruz, so I was a junior lifeguard in Santa Cruz for something like 9 years and spent a lot of time at the beach. No, I never learned to surf. Everybody always asked me, did you learn to surf? No, I didn't learn to surf, but, you know, I used to swim a lot, so I'd be out there swimming in that really frigid water pretty much every day as a kid. And then I went to school, went to college down in Los Angeles and back to Santa Barbara for graduate school, and I've been living in Santa Barbara up until just the past few months when I moved up here to Ashland.
Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit about your, I'm really interested in the experiential stuff, so I'd like to talk about, first of all, people will probably misinterpret what the word Mescalero means. So let's define that and then talk about your time with the Apache.
Okay. Well, Mescalero, I'm sure many of your listeners in the audience are thinking, oh, wow, these are like peyote Apaches. Not what it means. Mescalero, there's many different things actually in the Southwest that are called mezcal, and the mescaline inside peyote is just one of those things. There's also an agave plant that is generally just called mezcal. This is what tequila is made
from. Sure, sure.
For the mescaleros, and for many people of the Southwest, this is a food staple. And so what they do is they go out into the desert and, you know, these big agaves, and if you know what an agave looks like, they're kind of these big spiky things, also called century plants. And they have to take a wedge and they jam it down underneath the bottom and they kind of lop it off and they leave the roots in the ground because it'll regenerate, it'll regrow. So they kind of take the head and they cut all the leaves off. So it's kind of like this big pineapple-like looking core of the plant, which then they will bury in an earth oven for 4 to 5 days and they cook it. It comes out, and you kind of have to peel it off. You peel off this leather skin, and then it's really sweet, kind of molasses tasting, and it's also very fibrous. And you kind of have to pull off this juicy fruit of the mezcal, and so that's what they're named after. So mezcaleros is just the people who eat mezcal. And so as Spaniards were coming up through Mesoamerica, and they encountered this group of Apaches, they're like, these guys are the mezcaleros. This is all they eat.
All right.
Tons of mezcal.
Okay, but they still practice an interesting version of shamanic technique and medicine, I guess. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what they taught you.
Okay. Well, the official topic of my research out there was called the Mountain Spirit Tradition.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. So, I wrote that down, Mountain Spirit Tradition.
Yeah, so I'll tell you all about that and also kind of more on my own, I was spending time with the medicine people, kind of learning more directly about what they do as medicine people, which is really something separate from the mountain spirit tradition. So let's talk about the mountain spirit tradition. Among the Mescaleros, among this group of Apaches, there are two main ceremonial systems that they have. And one is called the female initiation ceremony, what they would just call the big teepee, because they make a large ceremonial teepee for girls who reach puberty. They go through this very long, elaborate ceremony where they become an embodiment of what in Mescalero is called Isanatlesh. And Isanatlesh is this kind of female divinity figure that comes back from the very beginning of time, where she emerged out of the waters of creation. And as she emerged, she was covered with this white clay. And that's what her name is Isanatlesh. Klesh is white clay, and Isana means woman who is painted again. So as the girls go through their ceremony, they're painted with this white clay. It's like put on their face, and it's put on their arms and on their legs. They become this white-painted woman, woman who is painted white again. And through her, it's a matrilineal society, right? The Mescalero culture is matrilineal, so it all goes down to the woman. And so this is just a very ancient ceremony, and the Apaches are an Athabascan culture.
What's that
which
mean?
Means that it means that they speak a dialect of this larger, broader language family that's called Athabascan. And this would include Navajos, and it also includes a number of peoples who live up in Alaska and Canada, and also in Northern California. These are all Athabascan cultures, and virtually all Athabascan cultures have a female initiation ceremony. So they have this very ancient tradition of initiating girls when they reach puberty.
Hey, Martin.
All these different cultures. Yeah.
Just as a side note, and maybe make a note, but I'd like to talk about the language a little bit later, and just so I don't forget.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
At any rate, okay, so the girls go through this elaborate, I guess it's sort of a coming of age at the puberty time.
Yeah, and they basically learn all about their culture as they go through this. They're instructed by the medicine people. They have to hire both a medicine man and a medicine woman to kind of be their sponsors to go through this ceremony. And really, to do it correctly, it takes years for them to be educated and trained. And one of the things they learn is how to go out and harvest mezcal and how to actually prepare it, and along with all the other traditional foods that mezcaleros would use. And so they have to learn all of these things. And they go through a very long, elaborate ceremony. And then they're now a woman after they've gone through this, and they've gone through this initiation. And they actually get a new name on the last night of their ceremony. They have to dance all night, and the medicine men are singing for them inside this large ceremonial teepee, right, just the big teepee, as they call it. And she dances all night long, and she's supposed to concentrate on the fire the whole time that she's dancing. And then at some point she might receive a vision, or, you know, might have some experience. And so in the morning, after the ceremony is all completed, she goes back into her own private teepee where she discusses with the medicine people what her experience was. And then they give her a name at that point. And then that becomes, you know, her Indian name, as they would describe it, out of Mescalero.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very ancient ceremonial tradition among the Mescaleros. And something that's much newer is what they call the mountain spirit tradition.
Hey,
and
Martin,
this is really something.
Martin, before you tell us about the mountain spirit, can I ask you a quick question about the boys? Did the boys also get an initiatory experience like the girls?
Not in the same sense, not with the same kind of intensity. And really that's something that has not been practiced very much in contemporary Mescalero culture, because you got to understand that this was more of a nomadic, you know, hunting culture. Right? They're out there going from mountain range to mountain range and hunting bison and hunting deer. And what was important for the young men would be to go on a vision quest, and that they did it totally differently than many people might be familiar with the idea of, like, a Lakota vision quest where you sit in a specific place and you wait there and, you know, you fast until you have your vision and you pray to the directions and, you know, you stay in that space. In Mescalero, they would take you out to a sacred mountain and they would tell the young men, start walking,
yeah,
you know, and pay attention. So there you go. you know, come back at, you know, 4 days or 8 days, however long it takes,
yeah.
You know, come back when you're ready. So they would kind of go on this wilderness quest. They would go out and they'd have to watch the animals to see where the food was, mm-hmm. see where the water was, mm-hmm. you know, watch the stars. And this is really where they were getting visions of the mountain spirits. So mm-hmm. this is, in one sense, is where this tradition comes from,
okay,
the mountain
okay.
spirits.
Yeah.
So the Mescaleros had migrated down into the Southwest along with the Navajo and all other Apache cultures. They migrated down from the north. And as they came down there, they, of course, encountered Pueblo cultures, which have all these masked dancers. They have a very different style of ritual system among the Pueblo people
mm-hmm.
in, you know, New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, down through that area.
Yeah, Four Corners area, yeah.
Right. So this is kind of their entry into the Southwest by having these masked painted dancers. That's what the mountain spirit tradition is. But the way that they describe it at Mescalero is that originally they have these different dance groups. So each dance group has four main dancers that they call mountain spirits or mountain gods, and then there will be additional dancers that they call clowns, and there might be anywhere from one to five clowns that are part of a group.
All right.
And they say that each group originated from a vision or a spiritual encounter that people had, you know, out on the mountain, or some, you know, somebody on their vision quest out there had this experience where they were, usually the way that the stories go is that the person is taken by the clown, because the clown is kind of considered to be the intermediary between people and the mountain spirits proper, because the mountain spirits proper are really embodiments of divine power. They are embodiments of the four directions, which is really how sacred power works in Mescalero thought. It's all through the four directions, east, south, west, north, always in that direction, right? That's sunwise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sunrise to midday to sunset to nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the process of creation. It's birth, growth, maturation, and death. It's spring, summer, fall, winter, right? This is the way power works.
Mm-hmm.
The power is this, it's a process. It's an ever-moving process. And in fact, the dancers never stop. These mountain spirit dancers, when they're performing ritual, they always have to be moving. Even mm-hmm. if they're standing still, they have to be shuffling in place, because the process never stops. Right? I mean, the universe is an ongoing process. It's
right.
not an object. It's an experience.
Right, right. And it's always moving, yeah.
It's always moving. So that's part of what they do in ritual. So anyway, the people have these visions of these groups. So they're taken up into the mountains by the clown, who is that intermediary between human life and, you know, these embodiments of divine power. So they're taken into the mountains. And then they're shown how to paint the bodies of the dancers, how to decorate the dancers. They're given the songs, and they're taught how to sing the songs. And then they're told, okay, it's time for you to go back to your people, and you can bring this back to your people. And some of the stories even say that then that person, that visionary, would come back to the larger family group, or, you know, back to where the main group of the different clans were, and that the mountain spirits would actually follow them, would come with them, and they'd bring them in and perform a ceremony so that everybody could see, and then the dancers would leave.
Hmm.
There's a lot of stories like that, of even in contemporary times, of when they've had ceremonies out on sacred mountains down there in New Mexico and in Texas. You know, when I was out there on the reservation, people were telling me stories about there was this time where this dance group just came up, and they started dancing with us, and nobody knew their symbols or their songs, and then they went back out into the woods, and they disappeared. So they're still talking about this as something that's continually happening now.
Mm-hmm.
So right now on the reservation, there are six dance groups of mountain spirits, and it's really considered to be men's business, that this is something that it's only male singers, it's only male dancers, and generally each group is led by a medicine man. Though he doesn't necessarily have to be a medicine man. But at this point, they're all led by medicine men. And other members of the group may be considered to be medicine men or not, but medicine practice is something that's even distinct from this kind of ceremony. But they can do blessings and healings, and, you know, you can hire mountain spirit dance groups out if you're ill or if somebody's in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You can hire them to perform a healing. You can hire them to perform a blessing. They can bless land. They can bless a house. If you build a house and you want to bless it, they can bless that. And they're always hired for the girls' initiation ceremonies, so they always perform for the girls. You have to hire a mountain spirit dance group and a medicine man and a medicine woman if you're going to go through your initiation ceremony.
How would you describe a medicine man or a medicine? Apparently, in this tradition, there are primarily men, and that's interesting because it's sort of a matriarchal tradition as well. But at any rate, could you talk about what it means to be a medicine carrier, whether you're a man or a woman?
Yeah, well, certainly in Mescalero culture, that there are both medicine men and medicine women. I guess I probably encountered more medicine men, but that was partly because of the circles that I was going in.
Right.
In terms of the mountain spirit tradition, that's, you know, women don't go inside the teepee. Women don't go in there and, you know, with this, when the dancers are getting prepared and things like that, it's really considered this is just men's business. So there are plenty of medicine women on the reservation. And actually, I worked really closely with just a beautiful medicine woman. Her name is Meredith Begay. She passed on just a couple of years ago now, but she was just such a beautiful, beautiful teacher. So I really appreciate my time with her. But to be a medicine person in this culture, first of all, and we can actually get back to the language, the word for it is Diyin. And a Diyin means a person with power. Diyin means spiritual power or the ability to perform, you know, spiritual work. And a Diyin is someone who has that, is a person of power. Or it might even be called a holy person. You might translate it that way.
Okay.
And really, that can take on so many different forms that... it's really about that person's relationship to their power. Now, traditionally, the way that they would talk about it is that someone has received a vision or has been given instructions and has this kind of relationship with, you know, the spirits, with what might be crudely put like a power animal or the spiritual form of things, really, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And so you can read back in some of the older anthropological material, and they talk about, well, one day somebody was walking through the forest, and an eagle flew up and said, I'm going to be your power, and if I'm going to be your power, this is what you need to do. People will have to give you certain objects to hire you, and for each medicine person, it's a different collection of objects. And once people give you these things, then they can hire you to perform medicine. And now I am going to teach you these songs, and I will teach you the ceremonies. And so people would learn this way. But also, medicine is something that you can be initiated into as well. So once there is someone who is established as a medicine person, who has gone through that process, kind of that visionary process, they then also have the power to initiate others.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can perform ceremony to bring someone into that medicine lineage, and they will teach you. These are the things that people will need to bring you, right? These original objects that were given by that power originally. And this is how people need to hire you, and that these are the kinds of things that you need to do for them.
Mm-hmm.
But then within that, each medicine person would be different. That they would use different herbs.
Sure.
They would use different symbols. Certainly there were and are herbs that are commonly known, but medicine people can also be kind of protective of their knowledge, and they would say, look, this is what I was told of how to use this, and this isn't necessarily how everybody else would use this plant, but this is the way I'm using it.
Mm-hmm.
And Meredith, again, the medicine woman that I worked with, she said she would just talk to plants. She said, well, you know, they just talk to me. They just tell me, you know, this is the way you use me. This is what you do. So for her, it was really ordinary. It was just, yeah, they talk to me. And I mean, she kind of laughed. And she said, yeah, maybe someday they'll just talk to you too. You never know. So, you know, just keep paying attention. And also at Mescalero, a lot of it is based kind of on a psychology of medicine practice. That, like, one medicine man, Paul Ortega, that I work with, he was actually president of the tribe for some time. He was almost flippant about it. You know, sitting in his house, he'd say, but look, you know, you can use a cucumber, you can use a refrigerator, you can use a microwave, doesn't matter. God's in everything. And it's just about the way you think about it. right? If you want to put your focus and intention into this thing, then that's a medicine object. If you want to put it into this thing over here, it's a medicine object. Doesn't matter. Fully up to you.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking about the significance of objects and how they become sacred, in a sense. And I sort of follow a Lakota way in parts of my life. I have some Lakota blood from my great-great-great-grandfather on my dad's side, and more than that, I just happened to make some great Lakota friends when I was living in Colorado and just sort of really got attached to some of the things that I learned, you know. But it reminds me of a bundle, you know, the Plains Indians, not just the Lakota, but the medicine people or the shaman or holy person, whatever you want to call them. They carried what they called a bundle. And inside the bundle, and I'm sure you know this, you know, was a collection or is a collection of talismans, objects, it could be all kinds of different things, but that bundle is sort of the symbolic root, the foundation of all their magic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that the same metaphor for this, for the way that the Mescalero people were?
Certainly. I mean, they would say, look, all medicine is basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would say different people use different things, but it all taps into the same source.
Right, the great spirit is where it's all coming from anyway, so.
Right. So, in that sense, anything will work. But the idea is that people establish relationships with the sacred objects that they're using. And that through that relationship, and it's a means of checking their own intention in a way and seeing how have I approached this whole thing? You know, how did I acquire? So if I've got an eagle feather in my medicine bag, how did I get that feather? You know, what does that feather mean to me? You know, for example, in Mescalero, they would never pick up a feather off the ground. And they didn't like this, but I did this because, you know, I'm out there in the woods. I'm like, oh, wow, beautiful feather. You know, I don't grab it.
Right.
And they're like, don't touch it. You know, they won't get feathers that way, that you've got to get it from a bird that you got yourself, or that you know where the feather comes from, that, you know, it can't just be anything in that sense. So it's not like they're just randomly taking things. So they're really thinking about it. But also in teaching me, what they would say is like, look, you know, our objects don't need to be your objects. Our symbols don't need to be your symbols. You know, we're going to teach you about these things, but it's up to every individual, it's up to every person to establish their own relationship with medicine and with power, and that you've got to collect your own objects, and that in doing that you pay attention to it and you think about, where do these things come from?
Right.
Is it something that you saw in a dream? Is it something that you saw in a vision? Is it something that came to you at the right moment, at the right time? And what is your relationship to that thing? And then it's really a voyage of discovering, well, how do I even use this? Because you know what? In Mescalero culture, nobody's really going to tell you how to use things. What they do is they show you, right? And spending a lot of time with the medicine people, what they would do is they wouldn't outright say, do this, do that, is that they would say, okay, someone's coming over today, and I'm going to be working on this person, and you can sit right there. Right? And then that's it, right? I sit right there.
Right.
And then I get to see what goes on, and then the person leaves, and then the medicine person turns to me and says, okay, so you can do that, but it's your own way.
Right.
If you want to do something like that, you've got to learn your own way to do it. But this is how we do it, and, you know, you can do these things too, but everybody's got to learn their own way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's so resonating with many other traditions, you know, from around the planet, with regard to good teaching technique. I mean, if nothing else, you know, it's, you know, a good teacher won't show you the answer, but they'll show you maybe some ways to get to the answer, but tell you, well, look, here's the tools, and this is how I use them, but you go your own way. It has to be unique. It will always mean more to you if you figured it out yourself, or if it came to you in some, you know, interesting and synchronistic manner than if it just came because somebody else told you to do it that way.
Yeah, and that's really the way it's got to be. It's got to come down to, your individual experience. Hmm. You know, that there's a great difference between having an intellectual understanding of something and then actually experiencing that,
right.
doing
yeah,
that
about it.
Itself.
Yeah.
And so it's really, it's a different way of encountering knowledge and encountering experience. I think.
All right.
So, you know, in many respects, it felt like it was a different world out there when I was studying at Mescalero, you know, especially coming from school, you know, graduate school, where you're reading books all the time, and there's so much book information. And I've got a lot of book information shoved inside my head.
Right.
I've read a lot of books. But actually getting out there and learning through observation and practice and experience is just totally different. It's totally different than abstract intellectual knowledge of things. And I would certainly say that's true for all spiritual experience. I mean, you can intellectually understand what a mystical experience is, but if you haven't had it, you know, you don't really know.
Isn't that the truth? All right, look, that's a good place to take a little break, okay?
Excellent.
All right, we'll do it, and we will come back, and we will talk some more, ladies and gentlemen, with Dr. Martin Ball. Martin, on the web, martinball.net, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, martinball.net. We'll come back and talk with Dr. Martin Ball in just a few minutes. In the meanwhile, we'll hear another piece of his unique music. This is called, appropriately, Mescalero Days. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia. Oh, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Back with you here. It's Mike Hagan, and you're listening to Radio Orbit. It is about 22 minutes before the hour of 1 a.m. now on the 18th of March, 2008. My guest is Dr. Martin Ball. You can find information about Martin on the web at martinball.net, among other places. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of his other interests and websites and some of that stuff as we get a little bit deeper into the program here. Hi, Martin. You still with us?
I'm still here. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for being here. Let's see. You are in Oregon. Is that right?
Yes.
What's it like up there?
Right now, it's a little bit rainy, a little bit wet. So I'm living in Ashland, which is a pretty small town. It's about 20,000 people in Ashland. We're just across the border from California.
Okay.
And kind of you go up over the mountains past Mount Shasta, then you come down the mountains, and there's a valley here. It's called the Rogue Valley. And Ashland's kind of tucked up in one little corner with the mountains going up on one side and the valley going down and more mountains up on the other side. And Ashland is pretty much famous for its Shakespeare Festival. Yeah. It has just top-quality Shakespeare here, and I think festival season has started. So there's going to be a lot of plays and a lot of people coming around to see the plays. And actually, you know, I grew up in Northern California in Chico, and I came up here a few times with my drama class and my English class, coming up here to see some plays. And a lot of artists live here, a lot of really interesting people. It's a very spiritually active place, and boy, they've got all different kinds of things going on around here. There's collections of the Native American Church. There's Santo Daime. There's the Unio de Vegetal is out here.
Sure.
So there's just all different kinds of things here in Ashland. It's really pretty amazing for such a small community.
Wow, sounds great. All right. Let's talk a little bit about your books. We won't talk about Arduin yet. We'll talk about that a little bit later, and we'll talk about some of the fantastic stuff that you write. But, of course, it's all fantastic when you talk about mushrooms and salvia. It might as well be all Arduin, you know. But at any rate, your book, Mushroom Wisdom, how did you decide to write a book on mushrooms? And for people listening who aren't familiar, I imagine that we're talking about psychedelic mushroom psilocybin or at least something like that.
Yeah, we're talking about psilocybin mushrooms. Well, actually, to get to that book, I do have to back up for just a moment.
Yeah, I do. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I ended up writing this series of four novels, which became Tales of Arduin.
Oh, so that was sort of a precursor. Okay.
Yeah, I wrote all those books first. I started in 2002 with the first one, Orbi's Vision, and just really became obsessed with these stories. I mean, it was really terrible. I don't recommend it. Lots of insomnia going on writing these books, you know, because the stories would kind of stack up in my mind. It's like, I've got to write this crap. And I don't have time to do it, and I need to sleep, and I need to rest, and that I need to write. And so it was really obsessive. And so anyway, I wrote these four books over a series of about 2.5 years. And when I got to the end of writing those books, I kind of reflected back on it and thought about how so much that was in those books from any kind of spiritual perspective was really coming from my own experience and lessons from psilocybin mushrooms. And so actually there are mushrooms that take place, or the use of mushrooms and ceremony that take place within the stories itself. But I'm not just talking about those parts of the book. I'm talking about the whole metaphysic and psychology and spiritual arc of the stories really come from my experiences with psilocybin. I mean, among other kinds of experiences as well, but really that was a foundation for many of the ideas that I was working with in the stories. And so after I wrote that, I was like, you know, I bet I could take all those ideas and just put it into a book about mushrooms. Yeah. That's really where it all came from.
Your original or at least a motivational interest in psilocybin, tell people the story about that maybe. I mean, because I'm sure people are saying, well, wait a minute, the Mescalero tradition that he studied wasn't one that used psychedelic mushrooms, and so how did he get interested in this? And I would like to mention, while I'm thinking about it, that you told the story when you and me were talking together with KMO from the Sea Realm a few months ago, which is how you and me actually met. And I wanted to give a shout out to KMO and say hi and thanks for the great work that he's doing as well. And maybe you could tell that story again. You and I both have bird connections and maybe carry bird medicine in a certain language, but maybe you could talk about your bird experience, or at least that particular one, and how you were introduced to the mushroom.
Okay, definitely. And also, I'll say hi to KMO. He said he'd be listening tonight. So.
Yeah, cool.
Hey,
cool.
KMO.
Hi, KMO.
Good he's out there. And, yeah, so, okay, so with mushrooms, I mean, I first encountered mushrooms at basically a hippie festival. You know, I graduated from high school. Right. My friend said, hey, let's go to Gathering of the Vibes.
Yeah, you're in Northern California. I mean, no problem.
Yeah, go hang out on the river. And, you know, a friend of mine got some mushrooms, and I ate some, and I had no idea what to expect.
Uh-huh.
I was like, wow, this is really weird, and I just got lost, and everybody's got weird looks in their eyes, and this is really strange. So actually, at first, I was like, this is really, really odd.
Mm.
And kind of uncomfortable. And, you know, I had some experiences with mushrooms, nothing that I would really call revelatory, kind of like, oh, you know, okay, now I understand what's going on. These are kind of fun, you know, this is pretty interesting. And, you know, fairies and sprites, okay, I can see where that kind of stuff comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a few experiences where really kind of wrapped in on myself and kind of negative and, you know, basically kind of a bad trip and, you know, kind of just busting your own ego and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, as I was moving into graduate school, you know, I became more aware and interested in ideas about shamanism. I started practicing Michael Harner's kind of what he called the core shamanism method of lying in a dark room and drumming really fast, bum, 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 and closing your eyes and going on these journeys.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that for a little while. And so the story that we talked about on the Sea Realm was when, this is basically the last time I did this specific kind of methodology.
You know, I want to mention Michael Harner, too, for people who aren't familiar. He's written some pretty interesting, you're probably talking about The Way of the Shaman. He wrote about it in that book, mm-hmm. that technique. But
yeah.
He also spent some time with this trippy tribe called the Jivaro, or the Jivaro. Man, the accounts of those the people of the waterfall, I think they call them. He's a really interesting guy and hard to get a hold of and all that. But for people who aren't familiar, he's another one to add to your list. So anyway, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I think he was a student at UCLA. I could be wrong about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was also a contemporary of Carlos Castaneda.
Mm, I think so, because he's been around for a long time.
Yeah, because they were all students with the Barbara Meyerhoff, I think, at UCLA together. So they were kind of part of this really a very interesting anthropological group, right? Because
right.
Barbara Meyerhoff was going down and studying peyote among the Huichol, and Michael Harner was going down in South America. So he was doing, like, DMT snuff.
Right,
like
that's right. That's why he went to go find the Jivaro, yeah.
Right, which is kind of interesting, because then in his core shamanism method that he basically said, look, just use a drum.
Right.
So, anyway, I mean, it's kind of interesting. And now this is something that is taught. I mean, you can get certified in the Michael Harner method, and, you know, there's schools, and, you know, you can become a Michael Harner shamanic practitioner. But anyway, so I was doing this technique, and on this last experience that I had, I had kind of identified with this golden eagle figure during these various journeys that I was doing, you know, locked away in my closet in the dark, but drumming away, bah, 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 with my eyes closed.
Mm-hmm.
And in this very last one that I had, I was in this really kind of a nondescript environment, but the eagle comes flying down out of the sky towards my perspective of where I am in this vision, and it lands down on the ground in front of me. And then where it lands, all these mushrooms sprout up out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of out of this vision kind of swirls sort of this rainbow version of myself. And then the eagle bends down and is eating these mushrooms. And this, you know, rainbow me appears and says, if you want to visit with the eagle, you need to eat the mushrooms. Okay.
Remarkable.
That's pretty interesting. So that was the last time, actually, that I tried that methodology. And then the next mushroom experience that I had after that was just this, I could just only describe it as this full-on Gnostic shamanic initiation into this experience with mushrooms, where my perspective about mushrooms and pretty much everything else just radically shifted. I mean, I would say that, kind of reflecting back on a point I made earlier, at this point in my life, I had a very strong intellectual understanding of a lot of these things that I had been reading about in terms of comparative mysticism and shamanism and things like that. But this was the experience that it was like, okay, this is no longer an intellectual understanding. I really feel like I think I know what's going on here, at least at some level, that I am really being communicated with here and receiving a lot of lessons and a lot of instructions about these things.
Did that particular time, that first time that you did it after you sort of had the vision from your drumming experience, was the... Okay, the set and the setting, which everybody knows is so important with regard to these things. Did you do it differently? Did you eat the same amount of mushrooms that you've eaten in the past? Did you grow them yourself? I'm interested in sort of the details about it. Was there anything different that you did, that would have also encouraged the experience to be significantly different than you'd had previously?
You know, I've got to say, at this point, no, I didn't really do anything different going into the experience, other than that I felt in a very different mental space, and I would say a very different spiritual space going into that experience. But the mushrooms themselves were some that my friend got, and we were up in his place. He was living in a communal house at the time. That's kind of an odd thing. I've never been in a communal house before. You know, people walking in and out of rooms and things like that. And it was 3.2 grams of mushrooms, which was probably more than I had had at that point. It probably was the most that I had had at this stage of my life. And it was just such a full-on experience. I mean, it lasted something like 9 hours, which is a little bit unusual. I mean, that's kind of long for a mushroom experience. But I just feel that going into it, I was just in a very different space. And then coming out of this, I just felt ecstatic for weeks afterwards. I mean, it just felt like I was just floating through the air. My God, what an experience. What an experience. It was like all these things had suddenly opened up in a way that was so much more meaningful to me than they ever had been before. And kind of in the first time in my life, I would say I developed a sense of faith and belief that, you know, this stuff is real. This is really going on. This power, this energy, this ability to tap into knowledge and, you know, manifest this stuff. It's really there. It's totally there. And before that, you know, I grew up in a very rationalist, skeptical, scientific household.
Right,
if you can't see it, can't touch it, can't taste it, it's not there. Here was this complete revelation in my world. It just cracked it wide open. And, you know, thank God it did.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. I've had a similar experience, but you know, it's amazing how few people actually do it, though. Okay, a guy like you, right, had all kinds of different experiences. You've been around and around, and you're an educated person. You have degrees. You know a lot about history. You know archaeology, anthropology. I'm sure you know a bit about genetics and microbiology. You know a bit about all this stuff. You've spent time with mescaleros. You know, you've done all these things, and all of a sudden something, you know, you do something that's pretty simple for pretty much anyone to do if they have the gumption, and you say, oh my God, this was a big deal, you know. You would think that it would be, you know, 4-inch headlines or whatever, but it just never sort of gets there. And one of my friends, I forget who it was, but back in the day said, you know, well, Mike, it's a secret that keeps itself. And
I like that.
Yeah, it just sort of makes its way to the people who, you know, need it or will appreciate it or will work with it in a symbiotic relationship manner, and then it will do its thing, you know. And it is amazing when it does its thing, you know.
Yeah, you know, I really think that that's a good way to think about it, and I certainly don't want to say that from an egotistical perspective that, yeah, it chose me or something, but
well, yeah.
I do think that, that people receive what they're capable of receiving
mm-hmm.
in a way. And, you know, if I would reflect on my own experience, I would think that, okay, so I was given some lessons through this, and I have a good communicative ability, and so maybe that's part of why I was given this experience, that I am able to communicate that to other people, and I didn't for a long time. I mean, this was a number of years ago that this experience happened, but this experience is really the basis for the book Mushroom Wisdom,
mm-hmm.
right? That
mm-hmm.
those are the ideas and those are the concepts that I learned in this original experience and that, you know, shaped the, you know, the novels that I wrote and all of that and really shaped a lot of my life.
Okay.
And so it took a long time for me to really be able to communicate that in some kind of concrete form. But, well, the book exists now, and so there it is. And I've put the ideas out there, and people can do what they want with them. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and certainly some people have really resonated with it. And, you know, people write me emails saying, oh, you know, I've learned so much from this book, and, you know, it makes so much sense, and thank you for writing this. And
right.
I can just say, well, you know, I'm just giving you what I was given. So if it spoke to you, you know, blessings, you know, that's the best I can do.
Hey, that's a great way to look at it. And you know, the feedback is what it's all about. It's great to hear, you know, from people that they're enjoying your work and getting something out of it that like you thought they might. I mean, because, you know, you never know. You put it out, you think, God damn, am I crazy?
Yeah. That's so true.
You know. So, well, anyway, I think it's great, and I'm glad you've embarked upon it, and I'm sure you've got more in your bag of tricks. You have another book about salvia, which is pretty interesting. We've never really talked about that much on this program. We'll do that maybe after the break. We'll take a break here in about 5 minutes or so. But I do want to ask a question that a listener brings up with regard to mushrooms. And this is something that a number of people report and have sort of questions about. But this particular gentleman says, can we talk a bit about the communication that the mushroom has with us, as in the voice in your head after you eat them that says, eat more? But I think the general question is, you know, there seems to be some sort of communication going on with psilocybin, and in a unique way, it does seem to be verbal, where many people report, wow, this thing's actually talking, or some entity is talking through the mushroom, with the mushroom as an antenna or something. But at any rate, I'm not sure if you've ever had that experience, and if so or if not, what do you make about the communication in general that, you know, that mushrooms seem to be able to impart on human monkeys?
Yeah, well, my mushroom experiences don't tend to be so verbal, either interior or exterior, that
mm-hmm.
really there's a lot of silence in my mushroom experiences personally.
Mm-hmm. Primarily visual for you?
They can be very, very visual, yes, extremely
mm-hmm.
visual.
Okay.
But also, what really overwhelms me is the sense of meaning and the sense of clear communication that comes from mushrooms. I mean, it doesn't have to be verbal. And I've heard a lot of people talk about this verbal mm-hmm. nature of mushrooms. And sometimes I feel, you know, I will be silent for hours and hours. But if I'm working with someone, sometimes just, you've got to say this to this person right now. These
mm-hmm.
are the words to say, and
mm-hmm.
it just might be two or three words,
mm-hmm.
and they can have a profound
yeah.
impact on people.
Yeah, yeah.
But overall, I just think that mushrooms are just very clear communicators, however you're receiving it. I mean, that's one of the greatest things about mushrooms, is they're totally straightforward.
Yeah.
This is the way it is.
Yeah.
You know?
And
you
totally
don't need to ponder over it.
You know, you're absolutely right about the way, in other words, everybody experiences them differently. It's not like a homogenous experience that everybody experiences the same thing. They tend to address you as an individual. So that would make sense then that to some people there would be an emphasis on visual communication, on some audible, on some, who knows, everybody learns differently. Everybody communicates better through different sort of methods, you know?
Yeah, and you know, it's all about that communication of information. Information
right.
in so many different forms. And some
mm-hmm.
people, I mean, let's be honest, some people need a stern talking to. And this reminded me of a couple of years ago at Burning Man, a younger friend of mine telling me basically about this bad trip that he had, and he really wanted to talk about that he had had this experience, and that during his mushroom experience, there was kind of this, with this kind of fatherly figure sort of materialized next to him and was speaking to him in this voice, basically saying, you know, you're screwing up your life, you know, you've got to change all these things. And he's like, wow, this is really heavy. This really sounds like the voice of God talking to me, and I'm really having a hard time with this. And he ended up kind of not listening to the things that this voice was telling him, and then a couple weeks later he shot his friend in the foot because, you know, he was out, you know, stoned or something and drunk, and, you know, shot his friend in the foot with a shotgun. He was like, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? And kind of what was really interesting is that then he came and he was talking to me about this experience many months later, and so I'm kind of absorbing kind of the whole much longer story that he's telling me, and was not experiencing mushrooms at the time, but it's kind of this cascade of meaning that comes, and sort of reflecting on his experience. And then in talking back to him and saying, well, this is what I think was going on, and this is what you're being told, and this is the significance for your life, he looked at me and he said, you know, it's your voice right now is the same voice. Like, well, that's what the mushrooms were trying to tell you. So, yeah, it's the same voice. And for him, I mean, honestly, he just needed a stern talking to about what are you doing with your life, young man? You know, how are you using these things? What are you doing? And he really needed to focus on that and question that. And he tried to ignore it, and then he shot his friend in the foot. Damn, I guess I really need to take a look at what I'm doing with my life.
Wow. Amazing. All right, look, we are top of the hour, so let's take a little break, and then we'll come back and chat some more, all right?
Excellent.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Dr. Martin Ball. You can find information about this interesting gentleman on the web at www.martinball.net. And we got plenty more to talk about with Martin, so we got another hour to spend with him. In the meantime, we'll listen to a little bit of his own music as well. This one is called Skybound, and we'll talk about music with Martin a little bit later in the program as well. But we'll play a song first, and also, once again, the website martinball.net. My website is mikehagan.com. The radio station here is kopn.org, and once again, KMO over there at C-Realm, c-realm.com. And he does a great podcast and radio program and interviews a lot of interesting people, and does it on a weekly basis as well. So you can check out his show and give him a shout, okay? All right, it's Mike, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, back with Martin Ball in just a few. That's music from Martin Ball. It's called Skybound. And you're listening to it here on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is Radio Orbit. My name is Mike Hagan. And we do have Dr. Martin Ball on the line with us from his place in Ashland, Oregon. And thanks for sticking around late into the night there, Dr. Ball, with us. It is.
Thank you very much for having me here.
You're welcome. It's what is it? Going on a little after 11 o'clock now there.
I think so. I don't have a clock in the room where I am at the moment. So
that's nice, actually. All right. Well, I won't remind you. So, at any rate, people saying on the website to give you messages, they're really enjoying the music. So we'll talk more about your music in a little bit, but I want to talk a little bit more about your books first, including your book about Salvia divinorum. And this one really interests me because I don't know anything about salvia other than what I've read, and I've read some very strange stuff, you know, trip reports and this sort of stuff. But I've never done it, and you have written a book that's actually been quite acclaimed by some people who ought to know. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about salvia and what you think about it and what the deal with it is.
Okay, well, first of all, we'll just identify it. Salvia divinorum, for anybody who doesn't know what it is a sage plant that comes from Mexico. And actually, you mentioned Maria Sabina earlier. It does come from the Mazatec people.
Really?
The same people that Maria Sabina is. And among the Mazatecs, that they will use both psilocybin mushrooms and they will also use salvia divinorum. Mm. And this is the only sage plant that's known to have any kind of psychoactive properties to it. And the Mazatecs have been growing it for so long that it basically only grows from cuttings, that it will occasionally go to seed, but those seeds will only very, very rarely actually sprout and turn into a new plant. So there's only a very few varieties of salvia divinorum out there, and scientifically, quote-unquote, we actually only know of like three different varieties, and even then they might not be so distinct from each other.
Okay.
And so it's really just these plants that have been propagated for, we really don't know how long, how many generations the Mazatecs have been doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a staple plant, and if you read like Maria Sabina, and some other Mazatecs, that they will describe salvia as something that they would go to as a substitute for mushrooms.
Okay.
But according to Daniel Seberg, who's been down there among the Mazatecs, he says that some of them prefer salvia to mushrooms, so that they prefer that as their primary teacher. And
Well, it makes sense, again, like we were talking about before, you know, sort of different strokes, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that some people resonate with different things. And
right.
I do got to say that a lot of people do not resonate with salvia. A lot of people who use it just come off saying, that was bizarre. I don't know what to make of that.
Hmm.
You know, even people who are experienced with entheogenic substances might come away just saying, you know, that's a bit too much. That's just strange. Because it's very, very different. Daniel Siebert, who runs sagewisdom.org, actually the one who identified salvinorin A as the active ingredient, so to speak, of salvia. And it is completely unrelated to any other entheogenic compound known. So it's totally unique. So
It's not a tryptamine, right? It's not in that group. It's not an alkaloid like that. So what is it?
You know, I don't really have the answer to that, and I'm not sure if anybody really else does.
All right, so it is different, though, for sure.
Okay. It definitely is different, but it's not really known how it affects the brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we know with the tryptamine alkaloids, excuse me, that they're basically working as neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm.
That they're being taken up by these receptors that we have in our brain that just kind of gobbles this stuff up. But salvia doesn't work that way.
Huh.
Not really known at this point, to my knowledge, exactly where salvia is affecting us. But it certainly is effective. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It certainly does work. So,
does it have to be prepared, or do you smoke it, or do you shoot it, or do you freaking snort it, or how do you use it?
Okay, well, among the Mazatecs, what they would do traditionally would be to take a large number of leaves, usually like 13 pairs of leaves, and they kind of roll it up into a big cigar and kind of munch on it and just keep eating those leaves. And I got to tell you, it kind of tastes like bitter spinach, which if that sounds like an oxymoron, it's not. There is, the spinach can be more bitter, and it's salvia. So it has kind of this bitter flavor to it that when you start, you know, it's not so bad. And then the further you go, the more bitter it becomes. And it's, wow, this is really getting hard to chew. So they would actually chew it and swallow it, or they might make a tea out of it. And according to the research that Daniel Siebert has done, it's actually being absorbed through the mouth, through the oral mucosa of the mouth, specifically under your tongue. And so eating it is actually not necessarily effective. And the least effective way to be using it would be to make a tea out of it, because you've got to use a lot of leaves. And really, you can swallow as much as you want. It's just the stuff that's in your mouth that's really making any kind of a difference. So when salvia was introduced to North America, people started experimenting with it by smoking joints. And nobody was really getting anything from it. It was like, oh, this kind of like weak marijuana or something like that, and people weren't really getting a whole lot out of it until somebody decided, well, why don't you try smoking it out of a water pipe or something like that, and that's where people suddenly found, okay, this actually is extremely effective. And the problem is that salvia burns really, really hot, and so when people were rolling cigarettes out of it, you know, it burns so hot that you don't want to take in a lot of smoke. Smoking it in that form, because it's pretty harsh, but you do need to take in a pretty good amount, and you need to hold it in for quite a while. I mean, it's really, you kind of hold your breath as long as you can. And if you're just using regular salvia, just, you know, just dried leaf off of the plant, you know, it takes quite a bit that you would have to smoke to really get an effect from it. And also, you know, you can just take the leaves and chew them up and kind of put them under your tongue and keep it in your mouth that way. And also there are extracts now available, which would be an extract of salvinorin A in an alcohol solution, which then the advice definitely is to mix it with hot water. And then you hold that under your tongue, and that's a pretty excruciating experience, actually, because the alcohol really, really burns. That allows for the salvia to come on a bit slower, because when you smoke it and when you really get an effective amount, it comes on by the time you're exhaling, and it can be a very, very powerful, very, very radical experience. And now also there are forms of what is just called potentiated or enhanced leaf salvia that has salvinorin A extract added back onto the leaves so that you can just smoke a small amount and still get the full effect of it. But in that, it generally only lasts from between maybe 10 minutes to 30 minutes if you're having a larger dose, which would then be a longer experience. So it can come on very, very rapidly, and, you know, there's a lot of ways that I like to describe it. It's just sort of a psychedelic tsunami. And it really is like a tsunami. It's like this wave in the sense that it just flows and, you know, kind of curls through and around you and stretches out your whole body and consciousness into these fractal tunnels. It's kind of this hyper-dimensional nexus that's always flowing and moving. It's just such a very, very different experience, and it can feel like wind blowing through you, or it can feel like just this movement, this energetic movement that moves through your whole sense of being. And some people say that, you know, they feel like they're just getting smeared out across reality, or that reality is kind of folding in on itself like taffy and stretching. And so some people find it very disturbing. I actually had a friend here in Ashland who only recently tried salvia, and he said, you know, I really think I overdosed. It felt like I died. And he described his experience to me, and I kind of said, well, you know, it sounds like salvia to me. And then we did a session with salvia, and he said, oh, it's just like before. And I was like, okay, well, that's just salvia. That's what it is. And, you know, if that's uncomfortable for you, you don't want to do that.
Right, but don't do that anymore,
That's just the way that salvia works. It's just a very, very different kind of experience.
Does it? Do you find information there like you do, for example, with psilocybin? You mentioned earlier that that there's great teaching and wisdom and information available through the psilocybin elves or genies or whatever you want to call them, or the ancestors, as I like to refer. I mean, to me, it seems like they're people speaking through it. But at any rate, do you find a similar phenomenon with salvia?
Salvia for me is a very, very different experience. So if I'm going to refer to mushrooms as a straightforward teacher, I also like to refer to them as a mirror. That they're just mushrooms are a very nice, clean spiritual mirror, and it'll just hold it right up to you. And sometimes you don't like what you see in there, and sometimes you do. But that's really what it is. It's very clean, very clear. Now, salvia, on the other hand, is like this trickster, pixie, very esoteric. Difficult to understand what's going on, and kind of reflecting on the comment that was in the chat room about the, you know, mushrooms say eat more. I mean, salvia is all about that. Salvia is just like, smoke a little more, come on, here we go, let's go a little deeper. Oh, how do you like that? Here's a psychedelic eddy for you as you get sucked into this fractal portal, you know? So it's really different, and really what I've learned with salvia, what's really done it for me with salvia is that it is very vibratory in nature. It's just this energetic vibratory flow, and something that I write a lot about in the book Sage Spirit is how I've gone through this whole process with salvia of working with sound, and it's actually taught me throat singing. We were playing a song earlier that Efra Marani, where there's some throat singing in the song, and that's actually an older style of throat singing that I was using, that salvia just completely reorganized me and kind of said, no, do it this way. And not even the sense of do it this way, it was actually this experience where my throat kind of shifted, and these sounds started coming out of my body, and it felt like this energetic persona had entered into my body, and it was not so much, I'm going to teach you something, it was just like, I'm using your body, and this is the way it's going to work, and this is the sound that's going to come out.
Oh, man.
And just opened up whole new levels of understanding, kind of this infinite range of vibrations suddenly appeared that just, wow, you know, just opened me up to a whole new perception of manipulating sound with my voice in a way that it just totally blew me away. And, you know, I mean, I've had a lot of other different kinds of experiences with salvia, but it's more about the experience itself rather than the knowledge or the information that comes from it. Because it's so much more difficult to really interpret, and it's not like this communication. It's just this energetic experience, and you really got to flow with it. And certainly I found that people who are startled by that or who fight against it have a really hard time with salvia. You know, I mean, some people smoke salvia, and they freak out, and they get up, and they try and run away. I mean, this person wrote me an email a few days ago saying that, you know, he tried salvia with a friend of his who was supposed to be his sitter, and he said, my sitter did a terrible job because he was supposed to keep me in the room, but that as soon as the salvia came on, he felt like he was being stretched out and going through this, you know, this weird movement of just stretching out of reality and then folding in on itself, that he got up and tried to run away, and he, like, opened up his apartment door and ran out into the street. And he's like, yeah, good sitter I had there. but that, some people, that's a common experience with salvia. It's like, wow, this is freaky. How do I get out of here?
Right. What about, and I'm not sure how frequently or how many times that you've done it, but the only real comparison I have is psilocybin. I don't know much about any other psychedelic plants, really, frankly, at least not from an experiential point of view. But my experience with psilocybin is that it is a two-way street sort of relationship thing, and that the longer you stay involved with the relationship, and, you know, if you sort of, like any relationship, it sort of requires work, but it becomes more familiar, and you can sort of have a certain expectation about where some people would say, well, no, gosh, when you take mushrooms, you never know what to expect. My argument is, well, if you do it every 2 weeks for 6 months, you know, and really get familiar, it's like a girl almost. It's like, you know, if you do it once a year, well, it's like a one-night stand or something. Well, if you do it every 2 weeks, it's no longer a one-night stand. It's a relationship, and you're getting to know that other being or something like that. Have you had that experience with any of these plants?
I would definitely say that, yeah, the longer you work with something, the definitely more you're going to learn about it. And, I mean, just in comparing mushrooms with salvia, I really do feel that they have just totally different personas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even though every experience is different, I mean, I'm really going to agree with you that if you get to know them, it's like, okay, this is a mushroom experience. I can completely tell this is a mushroom experience. It has all these characteristics of a mushroom experience, but then there's lots of novel things that are going on here. But, you know, these are all mushroom experiences, things that I'm going through. And the same way with salvia. I mean, I've had such a wild variety of different salvia experiences, but it's still salvia. I mean, I know distinctly. It's like, okay, we're in sage space now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is salvia. Hello, sage. And actually, something that I found is I really talk to salvia a lot. I mean, it's kind of interesting because mushrooms, I'm just totally quiet. I'm really a silent person.
Mm-hmm.
Salvia, especially after I've gone through my experience, you know, and I get kind of overwhelmed with this throat singing, and I'll do it for like 30 minutes, and then I'll come out of it, and I just babble away. I just, you know, I talk to salvia like it's a person sitting in the room with me. I'll just babble and babble and babble, and it starts out with just, I just want to thank you. I've really had a great experience. Just thank you so much for sharing this with me. You know, and I'll just rattle off whatever's on my mind or whatever comes out of that experience. But, you know, I just feel like, yeah, you know, it's my friend in a way that, you know, it's sort of this whole other spiritual entity that I can visit with, kind of enter into that space and have some really radical experiences and, you know, really learn a lot of things. And, you know, so it's that character. It's just sage.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, in Mazatec culture, they refer to salvia as actually the Mother Mary, as sort of this pastoral figure that, you know, they associate mushrooms with the baby Jesus and they associate salvia with the Mother Mary. And so a lot of people call her, you know, Lady Salvia or something like that. I myself have, you know, never felt a need to do that. I mean, sometimes it feels more feminine, sometimes it feels more masculine in energy, but it's always just sage. It's just, hello, sage, you know, thank you for welcoming me back. It's good to be here.
Right, very interesting. Okay. All right, let's see. Legal status of it.
Yeah, salvia is legal in most places. It is currently under consideration for Schedule 1 status, both at the federal level and at a lot of local levels. Some states have passed laws against it. I was talking to KMO about this just the other day, that I had been forwarded email of an article coming out of Florida that they're looking to make salvia illegal in Florida. And I was really kind of irritated by the article because they say, oh, it's going to become the next marijuana and, you know, you hallucinate for an hour and, you know, it's all these terrible things. And, you know, for one, I don't think anybody who has ever experienced salvia would ever in their right mind compare it to marijuana because, you know, they're not even in the same galaxy. I mean, they're so totally different from each other. And to say that people are going to be smoking salvia like smoking marijuana. I mean, marijuana is something that people can smoke and chill out and interact with other people and listen to music or
right, still function.
Enjoy your time.
Right.
Salvia is this radical interior experience where you are launched into another dimension where you just, I mean, people just shut off from the outside world. They don't know what's going on around them for most people when they're taking salvia. It's just like, boom, you are sucked into this vortex and there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And it only lasts for like 10 to 15 minutes for most people. It's certainly not something that lasts for an hour.
Right.
Unless you're, you know, repeatedly smoking it. But even then, there are peaks and valleys to the experience. It's not something that's constant. And they're also saying that it's something like LSD. And again, I don't know why people compare LSD to marijuana. You know, that doesn't seem like a very logical comparison anyway.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Because how can you say, oh, it's like LSD, it's like marijuana? Well, it can't really be like both of those because those things are totally different from each other. But
right, and everything's different for everybody, like we've been talking about all night. And it's like, well, you know, if you really want to know, learn as much as you can about it. You know, my sort of rule is, if it grows from the ground and it's got enough, you know, there's enough information available about it to know that it's not going to kill me, you know, or give me any particular type of malady, well then, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'll try it at least once probably.
Yeah, you know, and that's really an important point about these different entheogens and psychedelics is that they do not harm the body.
Right.
You know, they're not addictive. They don't harm the body. They do not produce disease. They've been used by indigenous cultures for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and they're totally cool with it. You know, it's not disrupting their society. It's not genetically mutating them. It's not rotting their brains. It's not giving them strange diseases. These are medicines.
Right. I mean, you mentioned it earlier. You said that in one of your defining psilocybin experiences, for months afterwards, you felt wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, these things really have healing and transformative power. I mean, that is just hands down, that is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That these things, if used in a respectful way, if used in a way that's intentful, I really believe that they can be very, very healthy for people. They can be very good for people. And I'm not saying that to say, hey, everybody, you got to go out and do this. I'm especially not saying, hey, you got to go out and break the law. But, you know, if people are going to make that choice, I do encourage people to really try and learn about it and do it in a serious way and get the most out of it.
I agree.
If you're going to be using a tool that's this powerful, you know, get the most out of it.
Right. And you're
really
right. You got to learn about it. I remember, I always forget who says what. There's so many of these great people in our body. I think it was Robert Anton Wilson, actually. He said something, you know, the first stop on the psychedelic trip should be the library. Right? And, as you know, his point was learn about what's going on here. You know, have some knowledge about what you're getting. I mean, you're messing with your mind and your heart and your spirit and your my God, your sanity. So, you know, you shouldn't take it lightly. You should understand exactly what, to the best of your ability, what you're getting into. And then, as you say, go into it with a serious attitude and with, you know, intention that you feel is right-minded and good or whatever, and then say your prayers, you know, hold on.
Absolutely. You know, and it's something that I'd want to say about even going into these things seriously, that I don't mean that people have just got to be, you know, completely, what's the word, puritanical. That's what I'm thinking of. It's not that you have to be puritanical about this, because actually, I do find that both mushrooms and salvia and really these entheogens, they really do have a great sense of humor in many respects. And the universe has got a fantastic sense of humor. So, you know, it's not that everything has got to be so serious and dry and, you know, well, we're doing this and, you know, we've got to be serious about it. But it's about kind of that internal stance of being open and of being intentful and saying, you know, I'm open to the humor that might even embarrass me in this experience, or, you know, I'm also open to the hard lessons that can come. And that's something that people who are not really experiencing these things need to understand, is that, man, you can get some very hard lessons.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you don't want to walk into it just like, oh, hey, I just want to blow my mind. Because, you know, you might blow your mind.
You just might, yeah.
You know, you might really mess yourself up if you're not prepared to deal with what these things might choose to show you. And, you know, people tend to get shown what they need to see, not what they want to see, what they need to see. And
what's
sometimes that's really hard for people.
What's the old Rolling Stones song, right? You can't always get what you want, but you get what you need.
Yeah.
And that's exactly right, I think. And I think that's why that's the bad trip for lots of people. Well, they just saw something that they didn't want to see, and usually, like you say, it's a mirror, and they're seeing it in themselves.
Yeah, you know, and if you can approach that with a sense of openness, and, you know, in talking about mushrooms, something that I wrote about in the book is kind of this idea of the witness, that something I found in the mushroom experience, that not so much with the salvia experience, but you really can enter into this state where it's like this supreme detachment while still experiencing everything, which is, you know, this odd paradox that somehow you can witness everything and fully experience it but not be attached to it. And so you're kind of removed. It's kind of like, okay, well, I'll take a look at that really nasty thing in that mirror that's going to reflect on me and my life, and I'm cool with it because I'm from this detached state, and I'm gonna pass all the way through that, whatever that emotion is or whatever that darkness is, whatever it is that I've got to face, you know, I'll go with it because it's cool. I'm in this removed, detached witness perspective, and so I'll go ahead and let this play out. And I think mushrooms are just excellent tools for that kind of perspective. It allows for that to open up. But, you know, people have got to be aware of that and not get trapped into, oh, my God, I'm spiraling down into this terrible darkness with demons chasing after me. You know, that does happen for some people.
Right. Okay. All right, look, let's take one more break, and then we'll come back and we'll have one more segment, okay?
Excellent.
All right, great. Thanks again, Martin. All right, everybody, Martin Ball on the web. Dr. Martin Ball is found at www.martinball.net. And you can link over there from my site as well. He has a couple of MySpace addresses as well. We'll talk about after the break here because we're going to talk a little bit about some of his fictional work and also about his music. So we'll do that in just a few minutes with Dr. Martin Ball. Back with him in just a few minutes. In the meanwhile, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, about 1:31 now in the AM of the 18th of March, 2008. This one is called Light as Air. Light as Air is the name of that song we just heard there. And it was written, performed, produced, and recorded, I'm assuming, by Dr. Martin Ball, who's on the line with us and has been for the last hour and a half. Been a pleasure speaking with you, Martin. And I'd like to talk with you a little bit about some of your fictional writing, the tales of Arduin, and also your music. A lot of the music that we've been playing tonight is related directly to some of your fictional writing material. So let's talk about it. It's all awesome, I think.
Okay, yeah. So the books you're referring to are Tales of Arduin, and it's a series of four books. And like I mentioned earlier, I started writing that back in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, this was after... as The Lord of the Rings was coming out, and I was rereading all of the Lord of the Rings books. And so 2002, I finished graduate school in 2000. Now, you've got to do a lot of reading to get your PhD in religious studies. So for years and years, I've read nothing but academic stuff. And then I got out of school, and things weren't quite working out on the whole job front kind of thing that I might have expected coming out of graduate school. And so I suddenly found myself with, wow, I've got time to read whatever I want. What is that? And I wasn't quite sure. So I got into reading Lord of the Rings, and I read The Silmarillion and The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and I read them all in that order. And before that, I'm back, and I read all of the Dune books. I had read the first Dune book.
Oh, Frank Herbert,
I had read that first one when I was much, much younger, and I had never read any of the rest of the series. And mm-hmm. so now, I found myself with time, so I read all of the Dune books, and then I read all of Tolkien's stuff. And then literally when I finished reading the very end of Lord of the Rings, it was like 10 o'clock at night, and I was teaching at UC Berkeley for one term at the time, and I was like, I want to write my own epic fantasy. I guess I'll start. And I turned on the computer and I started typing. And this is what I mean by getting this obsession that suddenly, like, the story was formulating. And, with all my academic background and whatnot, I was really into the idea of languages. I'd studied Sanskrit, Navajo, Apache, a little Tibetan, and then French, Spanish, the standard ones and whatnot. And I studied a lot also of linguistics and, a little Lakota, a little Chumash language. So I had a lot of exposure to different languages. And so I started creating different dialects and languages for the stories. And then it just became overwhelming. And then there was a map. And, then there's suddenly there's like all these characters. And I don't know what this story is doing. And then it just got bigger and bigger. And, I wrote the first book, and then I was just terrified. It's like, my God, I've written this book, and, it's nowhere near the end. And, can I get to the end? Can I even do it? I don't know. Huh. And it really kind of scared me as a literary adventure.
Right.
And so I took a few months off, and then finally I understood, this is where the story needs to go. And then at that point I just started writing, and I just wrote all of the second book, and then I took a couple months to think about it, and then I wrote all of the third book, and I took a couple months to think about it, and then I just sat down and wrote all of the last book. And actually the last book is the longest of all four.
Huh.
And I wrote it in like 2 months because I did almost nothing else for 2 months. I just sat there and I typed just all day long.
Oh my gosh.
And, and involved with this was like this almost constant insomnia because the story was like backlogging in my mind, and it got really complex. It got just all these characters and all these different cultures, and also coming from my background in religious studies, some of the cultures are more Native American, some are more Buddhist, some are more Taoist, some are more Hindu, and creating all these different mythologies and rituals and really just all of the stuff going into there. And then also kind of the spiritual foundation of these stories kind of coming out of my mushroom experiences, and then even writing about dreams, dreams became chapters, and then even some experiences I had out of Burning Man became chapters, and, Salvia became chapters in the story, it's woven into the characters and their experiences. And so, it took me about 2.5 years or so, or 3 years, to write all of those stories, and They're completely self-published, and I bought an ISBN number for the first one. The first one is Orb Eyes Vision, and it's available on Amazon. It's kind of out there in the world, and you know, people can order them as paperback books. They're actual honest-to-goodness books, and they're also available as PDF downloads for people who want to read it on the computer. But I bought the ISBN for Orb Eyes Vision, and then the other ones I have available. People can order them off my website, or they can get them through lulu.com, which is the actual printer of the book. And so book number two is The Fate of Marani. Book number three is The Alchemist and the Eagle. And then book number four is called The Fifth Temple, which if you've ever been to Burning Man, you know that the temple's pretty important out there. I don't know. Have you ever been to Burning Man? I haven't asked you, Mike.
I haven't actually. No, I've had many people ask and many people invite me to go. And if I could find, I'm not sure when it's coming. It's actually coming up pretty soon, isn't it?
Well, it's always the week leading up to Labor Day weekend.
Yeah,
so we've still got a few months to go.
Oh, okay. So it's at the end of August. That's right. Well, I just haven't had the gumption or the scheduling thing that just worked out where I've done it yet. But I certainly, it's certainly one of the things that I'd love to do. I sort of feel like, well, I missed out on the good years in a way, you know?
Well, I've been going since 2001, and it's definitely getting bigger every year, but every year it's a new experience, and I really get a lot out of Burning Man. And it's really been influential in many ways in the books. And I've had a lot of interesting experiences with the temple. Every year there's a different kind of temple that's built out of Burning Man. And I've had a lot of interesting experiences out there with the temple in different mental, spiritual states, and really worked a lot with it. And so the last book of the series is called The Fifth Temple. And,
cool.
And actually underrunning a lot of the stories as well is a lot of what I learned from out at Mescalero. For anybody who's seen the books, they will notice that each book is a different color.
Mm-hmm.
There's a black, black, green, yellow, white.
Uh-huh.
So at Mescalero, the mountain spirits, they're associated with the four directions, and each direction has a color. And the main color pattern at Mescalero is actually black, white, yellow, green. And in my story, what I wanted was to use those colors, but I didn't want to just use the Mescalero colors, so I reorganized them a little bit. So it goes black, green, yellow, white, and it refers to kind of the sacred geography of Arduin, right? This is Tales of Arduin.
Yeah. Arduin's a place in the book, right?
Right, and so this place has four sacred mountains. There's the Black Mountain, the Green Mountain, the Yellow Mountain, and the White Mountain.
Mm.
And it all has to do with the entire metaphysic of the story. And so Orb Eyes Vision, he has to go on a vision quest. He has to go to each of these four mountains to collect jewels and gems, and he puts them together into kind of this Tibetan-like mandala and has this vision of this apocalypse that's coming, that he was created to... He's involved with this apocalypse somehow, but he doesn't really know how or why, and so that's kind of... He has to go on this vision to understand this, and so then he sees a few years into the future about what's going to happen, and then the rest of the story is kind of catching up to that apocalyptic moment and really why Orb Eye is there, and this other character, Marani, why she is there. And it's all about those four mountains. And just to give you a little bit of an idea, those mountains, in the mythology of the story, they were originally temples. So there's four of them. There's four temples in the four directions, and each one's a different color. And so the last book is the fifth temple.
Amazing. Well, it sounds like interesting work, and I hope that people will take the chance to go over to your website. I know there's a bunch of different little samples of this and that are scattered about. You have is there a website actually devoted to the Orb Eye story? I think it's myspace.com/Orb Eye. Is that right?
Yeah. That is one of them. That's kind of the MySpace page for it. So something I often do is I create music to go along with my other creations. So
right.
So with Tales of Arduin, there is also the music of Arduin.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've recorded all this music that either fits specific scenes in the stories, or it's kind of more of a general mood of the stories. And so that on MySpace is just Orb Eye, O-R-O-B-A-I. And that's kind of presented as a band, in a sense. I mean, that I do this a lot because I do a lot of different styles of music, and I think it's a little bit easier for people to latch on to it if they kind of think of it as a band of like, oh, here's this style of music. Anyway, so Orbi is kind of presenting the music of Arduin on MySpace, but there actually is an Arduin.net, A-U-R-D-U-I-N .net, and that's the main webpage.
Okay, Arduin.net.
For the books themselves. Yeah.
All right, Arduin.net. That's another one to add to the list there. And let me ask you a question about the music. You mentioned earlier, and I recognize it, this throat singing thing. I'm fascinated by it. I saw this movie called Genghis Blues. A strange. Do you know the movie? You probably do. I mean, because it's such an obscure sort of topic. But if you're interested in throat singing, well, this movie called Genghis Blues was sort of a documentary thing about this guy. I forget his name, Paul something or other, but lived on the island or lived in California or something, but then went to the island of Tuva, where these great throat singers live and perform. And anyway, I think it's fascinating. How did you learn to do that? You mentioned earlier that it was related to salvia, but had you interest in it before then?
Well, way back when I started graduate school, probably in 94, 95, this band from Tuva, which is actually out in the middle of Siberia, this band from Tuva was coming to give a free concert at UCSB, and the band was Hunhur 2, which is really one of the most prominent bands to come from Tuva. And I had heard about throat singing, and I was familiar with Tibetan chanting at that point. But I had heard, you know, the Tuvans do a lot more.
Right.
Because in Tibet, if anybody who's familiar with Tibetan chanting, they're basically doing one form of throat singing. Tuvans have anywhere between 5 and 7 distinct forms of throat and or overtone singing that they perform in their culture. So really the Tibetans are getting it from the Tuvans. And it's also something that you'd find in Mongolia, and it's something that's found in Inuit culture as well. So that there are some cultures in, you know, Aboriginal North America that do throat singing as well. So I went and I saw this band play, and just totally blown away. Here are these little guys in these great little silk outfits, and they are producing these sounds that are just otherworldly, and they seem to be emanating from everywhere. It doesn't seem to be coming out of the person's mouth.
It was
soaring and vibrating around me. It was just completely phenomenal. So I lived about 10 miles away from campus at the time, and I would ride my bike. So I was riding my bike home, and I was, you know, I was trying to do all that stuff. Riding my bike, and I get home, and I struck out my four-track recorder, and I was like, I gotta start recording with this. And, you know, so I started, you know, using some techniques of throat and overtone singing. And so that was quite a while ago. And it's only been in recent years that I've had this kind of total reorganization from my salvia experiences, where I'm using completely different techniques of throat singing than what I was doing before.
And wow.
I get much more sound with much more variation and just, you know, a lot more energy behind it. But just basically kind of started working on it on my own, but the salvia really said, no, do it this way.
All right. You play lots of different instruments. I think that you're playing, correct me if I'm wrong, but most of the stuff that we're hearing is all you.
It's all me. There's nobody else in there.
All right, well, that's fascinating. Tell people a little bit about some of the instruments that you play.
Okay.
Well, obviously the guitar.
That's kind of where I started. Well, I guess I should say I started with a keyboard. I mean, way back in high school, you know, some of the older kids were, like, had a band. I was like, well, you know, I took piano lessons when I was really young. So can I play with you? So I started playing keyboard in kind of an alternative band, and then I really quickly took up the guitar. And, boy, back at the time, I was really into The Cure. I mean, just, oh, my God, you're so into The Cure. And so, you know, I wanted to make music like Robert Smith, pretty much. And so I was kind of playing alternative-style guitar, and then I started playing with another guy who was a better guitarist than me, so I was like, okay, I'll play bass.
Right.
So I started playing bass, and then I started playing keyboards in another band to do like some reggae. And I was also starting to listen to reggae and Bob Marley and Burning Spear and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's a real vibration. There's a Caribbean flair in some of your stuff for sure, yeah.
Yeah, so I started listening to that. And then actually you might notice that there's a lot of South American influence, too. My parents, my dad in particular, used to listen to South American music, like, all the time when I just grew up, like, listening to South American music with all the flutes and the little guitars and all of that stuff. And so then, you know, I bought some flutes and started picking up doing some flutes, and I got some hand percussion and started doing that, and then eventually in graduate school, you know, I met a guy who played the didgeridoo, and I was like, dude, you got to show me how to play that. I started playing didgeridoo, and then that was also around the same time that I started, you know, playing around with throat singing, and yeah, so I just kind of play all these different instruments, and more recently I actually bought a MIDI keyboard. That was kind of a big move for me. You know, the big steps for me were I changed from using a 4-track recorder to somebody told me, hey, you can download Pro Tools free. You don't have to pay for it. You can do digital recordings. I was like, sweet, that sounds great. That's my price range. That's totally my price range.
Right.
That's about all I can do. So I got Pro Tools free, and then for like 4 or 5 years I was on this complete acoustic kick where every instrument I played had to be like an acoustic instrument and just natural sound. And so a couple of the songs you played are kind of from that era of musically. And then more recently I started using GarageBand, and that inspired me to buy a MIDI keyboard for the first time in my life. So I bought a MIDI keyboard, and man, I've just been having a lot of fun with that because there's just so many different sounds and it's really easy to record music with it. So I've kind of been on a MIDI kick for a little bit, and now that I've moved into this new apartment, I'm kind of next to a busy street, so can't really record the acoustic instruments so much in this apartment right now because it would show up in the recording, so kind of the MIDI keyboard is where I'm at the moment. But I just love music. I love many different styles of music. I'm always trying to listen to new kinds of music and kind of sucking in new influences, so I mean, just in the music that you've played here on the show, I'm sure people can hear a lot of different styles and influences. And, you know, I hope that you people wouldn't necessarily think it's even the same person at times. So I do think that it kind of has a me sound to it. I don't know how I would describe that, but it sounds like me to me because it's me, but I don't know how other people take it.
Yeah, it's definitely diverse. You got a lot of different sounds there for sure, and they all sound great, actually. They're you span the these different genres pretty well. I like most of what I've heard, and I've got a whole selection of other ones. You've been pretty prolific. There's quite a bit of material out there, actually.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been recording music for a long time, and I really love it. You know, it's never anything that I've done professionally. It's just kind of me sitting around by myself making music, and I just love it. I just love making music. I love the sound of it. I can't read music. I don't know squat about music technically. I mean, you can tell me this is this mode or that mode or put it in this key or whatever. I don't know anything about that. I just know sound and vibration. And
that's what it's about. All right, look, we got time for one more question, and it's a good one, even though it's sort of dealing with stuff we were talking about earlier in the program, but because it's a good question and it's one that I've actually sort of experience myself, I thought I'd ask you. Somebody says, ask Martin what he thinks about delusions of grandeur on psychedelics. That's never mentioned enough. Is it only me, or do others notice that some people have their ego even more inflated on psychedelics rather than dissolved? And I thought it was a good question, because there have been times when I've come out of mushroom experiences where I've had that exact same thing happen to me. Thought that, you know, I was king of the world or something. I don't know, you know. But do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, well, that's kind of part of the whole divine comedy, you know.
Yeah, that's the trick.
The Russians, they've got a sense of humor, and they'll puff people up, you know, and then you kind of realize the fool that you were afterwards. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully that doesn't always happen. But I think a lot of that has to do with the sense that there is, especially in the mushroom experience, there's just this overwhelming feeling of meaning, like, oh my God, everything means something, you know. It's just this overwhelming sense of meaning, and if you get too caught up in that, in a sense, it can really blow out of proportion. It's something that I always try and keep in mind, especially with mushrooms. There's always a lot of different ways of looking at things.
No question.
And that you've got to remember that no matter how good or how bad some experience is in the mushroom experience, it can change in the blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. All you've got to do is look at it from another perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that delusions of grandeur can just be people getting carried away by it and not remembering to let me step back again into that more witness perspective rather than getting caught up in this. Let me take a more distance perspective at it and not be attached to it. And I think that's really key, of not being attached, which also means sometimes being really brave. I'm like, you know, I'm going to go through some scary stuff here, but I'm not going to be attached to it. I'm going to go ahead and invite it and just bless it and say, thank you for letting me go through this. And, you know, I'm going to make it through.
Mm-hmm.
But it is that more detached sense, I think, and that's where you can really make it a little bit more productive and, again, maybe get some perspective on it rather than, you know, just, I'm king of the world. I mean, it's kind of funny if you read, like, you know, Terrence and Dennis McKenna about their experience of, you know, where the book The Invisible Landscape comes
from.
Sure,
I'm not sure.
They ate all those mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, tomorrow everyone in the world will wake up and say, Dennis McKenna.
Right.
You know?
And they'll have
and
the answer to every question after they say the word Dennis.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, sometimes you got to step back a little bit and think about, you know, really, does this make sense for me in my life, you know, and kind of, you know, step away from it a little bit. So,
all right. Well, look, that is, we're pushing on 2 o'clock here now, my time, and it's time for me to hand the microphone over to somebody else, even though they haven't showed up yet. But it has been a pleasure, Martin, and really pleased that we had a chance to talk and have you on the program.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And, yeah, just thank you. It's really been great.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. And we'll get the MP3 up and in the archives. And thanks for your music as well. It's been awesome to be able to share some of that, too. So we'll get it up there and let some other people hear it, too, okay?
All right. Fantastic.
All right, man. Have a good night.
All right. You too, Mike. Thank you.
All right, everybody. Martin Ball on the web, www.martinball.net. Also, you can find him at www.arduin.net, and that's where lots of information and excerpts and stuff about the books, Tales of Arduin and the Adventures of Orubai, can be found on that website, okay? Anyway, great stuff from Dr. Martin Ball. It's been a pleasure talking with him tonight, and to all of you, as always, thanks for listening to the program. Come on back. Next week, my friend Kyle Cook will be my guest host. I'll be out of town for a week or so, so Kyle's going to do the program for me. So I encourage you all to listen to the program and give him hell, all right? And I'll be back on the 31st, and I look forward to getting back with you all then, okay? In the meanwhile, one more from Dr. Martin Ball. This one is called Song of the Muatan. You've been listening to it here on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Once again, it's Mike, Radio Orbit, back with you in 2 weeks. In the meanwhile, listen to Kyle, guest host on the program next week. KOPN now concludes its broadcast day. KOPN broadcasts on the assigned frequency of 89.5 megahertz with an effective radiating power of 36,000 watts. KOPN is licensed to the New Wave Corporation with offices and studios located at 915 East Broadway in Columbia, Missouri, and with transmitter and tower located at 4377 North Route Z. On behalf of KOPN and New Wave Corporation, this is Mike Hagan. I wish you a good night, or a good morning, or both. Come on back, 5:30 a.m. with Morning Air.